We're going to start with testimony from Representative Atkins on House File 3545. Chairman Eakin indicated that we would be starting the committee immediately after adjournment. We have a very long agenda, so we will start with Representative Atkins. I will not call the meeting to order yet, but if Representative Atkins, if you could maybe start to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. I see that Representative Clark is actually with us. I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill be heard. There is, I recognize that we're not moving the bill yet, Mr. Chair, but when we do, there is a delete all titled the DE1 amendment. This bill addresses high potency greenhouse gases. We're all familiar and have done made great strides with respect to dealing with carbon dioxide, and I'm proud to have been a part of that. However, there are some so-called super warmers. Things like sulfur hexafluoride and other compounds. Sulfur hexafluoride, by way of example, the equivalent of 1 pound of sulfur hexafluoride is the equivalent of about 11,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. 11 tons, actually, so 23,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. So if you want to get after greenhouse gases, you have to make sure that you address these. This bill does 5 things with regard to these super warmer compounds. It requires a report to the PCA, required to manufacture to establish the extent of the problem. It publishes leakage rates of automotive air conditioning systems. It phases out the most damaging motor vehicle refrigerants, and it prohibits the sale of small amounts of automotive refrigerant like they just did in Wisconsin. And finally, there's a report to the legislature on measures that will cost-effectively reduce these emissions. With that, Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of folks here to testify. First is Mr. Chuck Dayton.
Mr. Dayton, welcome to the committee, and if you could...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Charles Dayton. I'm a retired lawyer. I volunteer for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I was a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group. I was a member of the residential, industrial, commercial group that recommended that the state begin to deal with these high potential greenhouse gases. The charge to the advisory group was to come up with measures to get to the goal set in statute last year by the legislature, a 30% reduction in CO2 equivalent emissions by 2025 and 80% by 2050. So this is a preliminary estimate showing that we could get there doing all the things that NTAG recommended by 2030, but we don't make it by 2050. And this is a more recent iteration. And the green line shows that we don't quite meet the goal. With the goal is the black line, we don't quite meet it by 2025, and we certainly don't meet it after 2025. So this bill represents some of the things that we should be doing first, some of the low-hanging fruit that can be undertaken to as an early reduction of greenhouse gases. The bill that's before you is based on recommendation number 5 from the Residential Commercial Industrial Group. And that recommendation deals with particularly HFCs, PFCs, and SF6. And those are chemicals which are in part used as substitutes for chlorofluorocarbons, which were banned under the Montreal Treaty because they caused ozone depletion. Unfortunately, these substitute chemicals cause increased problems with global warming. The recommendation of the MTAG was unanimous on this point, and MTAG recognized that many of these gases are thousands of times more damaging in terms of global warming than CO2. The pink on this graph shows how these gases are expected to increase over the next 15 years or so unless we take some action. And the green line on this graph shows the same thing. that these are these uses will be increasing. So, if carbon dioxide is weighted at 1, hydrofluorocarbon 134A, which is used in car air conditioners, is 1,300 times more potent as a global warming gas. Sulfur hexafluoride is 23,000 times more potent as a global warming gas. The recommendation of the MCAG was to have a rulemaking process in Minnesota to deal with these gases and to ban the ones where substitutes are available at less cost and to phase out those gases where they can be replaced at a reasonable cost. This bill doesn't go as far as that because of financial constraints and the cost of rulemaking, but it takes the first step down that path and asks the PCA to do a report to the legislature on the uses of these gases, the substitutes, their impact on global warming, and the cost of using substitutes. And this is just an EPA ad warning people about leaks in their car air conditioning systems, which is one of the problems that's directly addressed by the bill. And Kevin Ruther, who's an attorney at MCEA, can go through the provisions of the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Ruther, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Kevin Ruther. It's R-E-U-T-H-E-R. I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I just want to take you quickly through the bill, and I will actually refer to the section numbers in the delete all. I think that makes the most sense. Okay. And I wanted to just start out by letting you members know that most of the ideas in this bill actually came from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and a number of folks throughout the country that we've been working with, including some experts at the Society of Automotive Engineers. This bill is important because it takes a first step and sort of gets us started working toward reductions and figuring out how we're going to get our hands around these very potent greenhouse gases. So just stepping through the bill quickly, the first section refers to the remedies available. That's simply giving the PCA enforcement authority over the following sections of the bill. The next section, section 2, has a number of definitions, and I'd just like to highlight three of those for you. The first is in subdivision 3, where it defines carbon dioxide equivalent, and you heard Chuck Dayton refer to that term. What that means is the amount of CO2, or carbon dioxide, that is measured in tons that has the same global warming potential as a given amount of another greenhouse gas. So, for example, if a gas is 100 times more potent than CO2, and you have one ton of it, then the CO2 equivalent of that would be 100 tons. So it's just a way of expressing these different gases using a common denominator, a common moniker. The second definition that I want to point out for you is global warming potential, or GWP. That's a number or a factor that measures the relative potency of a gas as compared to carbon dioxide. So again, using this example where we have a gas that's 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide, we'd say that its GWP, its global warming potential, is 100. And then the third definition I'd point you to is the definition of high GWP greenhouse gas. That's in subdivision 7. And again, you heard mention of these three gases as being high GWP greenhouse gases. They're hydrofluorocarbons, which are HFCs, perfluorocarbons, which are PFCs, and then sulfur hexafluoride, which is SF6. So those are the three gases that this bill is aimed at. Turning to the next section, section 3, this is a general reporting requirement. It has two different provisions. The first requires that manufacturers who sell these gases in Minnesota would report to the PCA the amount of the gases that are sold here. And then the second provision there requires that purchasers of the gases, and that's people who purchase over 100 tons of CO2 equivalent of the gases, would have to report those purchases as well and also state the use for which the gas is being bought. And the purpose here, obviously, is just to start to get a handle on where these gases are coming from, how many are here, what their uses are, at what rates they're leaking into the atmosphere. So that will be valuable information for the PCA as we move forward in getting a regulatory structure in place. Section 4 requires that car manufacturers report the leakage rates of air conditioning systems in new motor vehicles. Those rates would be posted on the Attorney General's consumer website, which would enable the public to have access to information about the leakiness of these air conditioning systems. There's a sort of like a grading system that the Society of Automotive Engineers has put together. And so depending on which tubes and valves and things the manufacturer puts into the air conditioning system, the leakage rate changes. And we'd like that to be made available to the public. Let's see, the next section, section 5, motor vehicle sales requirement. This really acknowledges that other jurisdictions are out ahead of Minnesota on some of these issues in requiring alternative refrigerants. In particular, in Europe and probably in California, they're going to be placing some requirements on use of alternative refrigerants in the future. Europe right now is requiring new automobiles as of 2011 to be able to use an alternative that's now available that has a global warming potential of something less than 150. The current refrigerant, as you saw from Chuck's slide that's used in mobile air conditioning units, is 1300, so that's a big difference. And what this section would do is it would require that auto manufacturers, 2 years after they've made these automobiles available elsewhere, would have to make them available in Minnesota as well. Section 6 is specifically about the small cans of refrigerants that get sprayed into air conditioning systems. As Representative Atkins mentioned, these cans have been banned in Wisconsin, and this portion of the legislation would also ban those cans here. And then Section 8, I'm just going to skip over Section 7, that's the general enforcement provision. Section 8 is really in some ways the heart of this bill. It's an important piece of it. As Chuck Dayton mentioned, this was a recommendation from the MCAG, the Climate Advisory Group, that met for the past year. And the recommendation coming out of that group was for a rulemaking because of the situation that we find ourselves in with a short session and not a lot of funds for rulemaking, come with is this study. And it will really provide an opportunity for the PCA to take a look at where these gases are being used and we're ready to wrap it up?
Almost.
Okay. And let me just give you one example. This I picked off our secretary's desk, and it turns out to be one of those dusters that's used on computer keyboards. And this actually has in it HFC 134A, which is a high GWP global warming gas. It has more potential. It has 1,300 times the potential of carbon dioxide. So 1 pound of the gas that's used in here equates to driving over 1,000 miles. And who would have thought that when you look at this little can? So our study is going to give up the opportunity for the PCA to figure out where these gases are being used, what uses are really essential, are there substitutes, that type of thing.
thank you, Mr. Ruther, and I, Representative Adkins, I understand that you do have another bill up and another committee here. So I don't know if you wanted to make a statement at this point. I know you have one other testifier.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if it's possible, and obviously it's a deference to the chair and the committee, I know you're not quite at a quorum yet, but if need be, I've got to make it to another committee that's going to adjourn by 5:30 or 5:40, so I got to have that bill. If you need me to come back to answer questions, I can do that, but I prefer once you get to a quorum, unless you've got questions now, if you could move the bill and the DE1, it's just got to be re-referred to the Commerce Committee in any event. I know that the department, Mr. Thornton in particular, was going to say they neither oppose nor support the bill, but that they are in the process of working on developing this in their own right with regard to at least one of the compounds. The Commerce Department had an issue, which I believe we're going to address in the Commerce Department. So I'm just trying to shortcut things a little bit for you and the community. I also know you've got a long agenda.
So, Representative Adkins, you'd prefer that just be laid aside and then come back when we have quorum, or
well, if you at this point, I've got a few more minutes before I have to run there. I don't know when you anticipate having a quorum. It looks like you're getting close.
We have it.
All right. I'm not aware. Nobody's approached me anyway that they're going to oppose this bill at this committee. That doesn't mean that we won't have some, but. I'd like to see if I can and try to get the bill moved.
We can do that. Does Mr. Thornton want to testify, or is that
certainly up to
Representative
Osmond? I wanted to try to express the department sentiments as best I can.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Osmond has a question.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3545.
Okay, and first we'll call the meeting to order. And Representative Osmond moves House File 3545. As amended, we have to move the amendment here as well. So we move House File 3545, and there is the delete all amendment. And
move the amendment.
Representative Osmond moves the delete all amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Mr. Thornton, if you would like to step down and testify. Mr. Thornton, thank you.
I must have been pretty accurate, I guess.
Yes. So any final comments to the bill?
Mr. Members, I appreciate your support.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none. All those in favor of, Representative Osmond, renews his motion that House File 3545, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Hansen.
I move the minutes from the last meeting.
Okay. Representative Hansen moves the minutes from the last meeting. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Nay. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And we are going to have, going to juggle it around just a little bit. Representative Clark, I understand you have somebody that will need to leave soon, so we'll have you come step forward first. So, welcome, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a handout, and I think that you also have
Okay, and I will move House File 3293 be recommended to pass.
Thank you. And there is an amendment in the packet which ends with A3. would put it in a form that I would like to have the bill considered.
Okay. And I will also move the amendment. It is the A3 amendment. Is that correct? To get it in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Clark, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. What I have before you is a bill that talks about the need for a Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to consider more than they do right now when they're permitting a facility that has environmental impacts. And what we say is that they have to analyze and consider the cumulative levels and effects of current environmental pollution on the residents and the area where the facility's emissions are likely to be deposited. Mr. Chairman, to make that a little clearer, on line 1.19, I was wondering if we could insert, if we'd be willing to move an amendment after the words, between the words current and pollution, just put current environmental pollution. I think it makes it just a little clearer. In talking to the agency earlier, it seems like that might be helpful.
Okay, and if you could repeat that, Representative.
Yes, on line 1.19, between current and pollution, if we could put the, insert the word environmental. And then, Mr. Chairman, I have a several, oh, I guess you need to vote on that first.
Yeah. 1.19. Okay. Okay, Representative Clark, again, on line 1.19, between current and pollution, insert the words.
Is that correct? Environmental.
Environmental?
That one word.
Okay. Yeah, the amendment that has been adopted did delete those words that you're inserting environmental into, Representative Clark, so that would not be needed.
No, it doesn't delete that. Oh, it does? Oh. I'm I guess I look at council. I don't think the intention was, Mr. Elop, to remove the additional language there.
Mr. Elop?
I'm looking at line 115 of the A3 amendment, which deletes lines 19 to 21.
I see. What Mr. Chairman, I intended to require that the cumulative impact would be the heart of what this bill is about, so I think that's an error in drafting. I didn't mean for the cumulative impact to be eliminated. I only meant that the geographic area would be limited. And so maybe the council can help us with that. The heart of the bill is to look at cumulative impacts, and so I'm sorry if that was a miscommunication with the
okay, Representative Clark, we'll take a look at it.
Should it work if you believe? Okay, so, answer facility. Always question.
While we're waiting, Representative Clark, why don't we go ahead with the testimony?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, members, what I'm concerned here is that we have a situation right now, and particularly in the one community that I think meets all the criteria that are in the amendment that we put on, which is a low-income community in which the majority of people are persons of color and American Indians, that is located within a federally designated EPA super fund site. In this case, it happens to be for arsenic, which is all over residential areas in our community. 500 yards have been removed, and 500 more yards are scheduled to be removed because of the incredible arsenic that's all over our residences. It has a disproportionate percent of children who have childhood lead poisoning, asthma, or other environmentally health-related problems. That's located in a city that's had 13 air quality alerts in the last year, and it's located near the junctions of several very heavily trafficked state and county highways and one-way streets. And Mr. Chairman, members, what I'm trying to get at here is an issue of environmental justice.
that we are concerned about any facility that would add to the burden, to the environmental health burden of the people who live in that community. And I have prepared for you, and our GIS folks here prepared for you, an overlay of the different kinds of issues that relate to those specifics, asthma, childhood lead poisoning, air pollution from poverty, and children and elders, in the maps that are before you. I guess we're having a little trouble getting that up, but this is the map here, and I guess maybe in lieu of having it work, maybe we'll just run through it in a moment. But I would like to first maybe ask Dr. Ian Greaves, who's here with us, from the University of Minnesota, to talk a little bit about the issue of cumulative health problems in terms of environmental exposures. And I'll let him introduce himself and describe why we think it's important to have this kind of a lobby for us.
Welcome, Dr. Greaves. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Ian Greaves. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, Representative, thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly before you about this issue. What we have in terms of Representative Clark's example is an impoverished neighborhood that already has a large number of environmental problems, as witnessed by a Superfund site, childhood lead problems, excess rates of asthma and hospitalization, and a lot of the issues of inner urban poverty already. And the environmental justice movement of the last 20 years has looked at inner urban communities like this and said this is an extremely vulnerable population subject to substantially enhanced adverse health effects when we put additional pollution into their environment. And in order to protect those vulnerable populations, the federal government and the state government of Minnesota have environmental justice policies, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has a policy dating from September 21 of 1999 that addresses environmental justice. And this policy says that the MPCA will, within its authority, ensure fair and equitable treatment and meaningful involvement of all Minnesota citizens in the implementation of federal and state environmental laws, rules, programs, and policies to ensure that minority and economically disadvantaged communities in Minnesota do not bear a disproportionate share of the involuntary risks and consequences of environmental pollution, that they are not denied equal access to environmental benefits, and that they have opportunities for meaningful participation in the development and implementation of Minnesota's environmental programs. This policy was designed to empower people who have little power and to ensure that they are not subjected to unreasonably or unburdensome risks. And I think in Representative Clark's example, with a new power generation facility being planned within this community, we actually see an example of potential environmental injustice. The policy includes both process and substance, the process of involving the affected community and also ensuring that there is not an excess risk to that community. Already within that community, there is an asphalt manufacturing plant, a Superfund site, a hot tar storage site, and a foundry. All of these facilities emit air emissions that are considered toxic. In addition, it's a relatively high vehicular traffic area, a lot of diesel, with particulate exposures. So we have a background of high air exposures to hazardous air pollutants as well as criteria pollutants. Of particular relevance in this community is the high fraction of young children, elderly, and those who have pre-existing heart or lung disease. All of those groups are at increased risk from environmental air pollution. The incinerator under consideration would put more particles into the air, would put more hazardous air pollutants into the air, particularly in the form of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which cause cancer, and heavy metals such as lead and mercury, arsenic and manganese, all of which have adverse effects on the nervous system, particularly in children. So we need to consider the added environmental burden from such a facility in relation to the existing stationary and mobile sources of pollution within that community. That can only be done by looking at a cumulative assessment of existing and proposed environmental pollution in this community. And in a community that already has substantial environmental related disease, I think this is a particularly important consideration. I support Representative Clark's bill because it would push the PCA to do more of these community-wide assessments rather than a facility-by-facility licensing and permitting. And I think the facility permitting here needs to be taken in the community context and the community environmental issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Greaves. Are there any questions for Mr. Greaves?
Mr. Chairman, I might mention that Dr. Greaves is an expert on respiratory issues in one of our clinics at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. And let's see, any questions at this point? Representative Clark, we do have an amendment that I think addresses
okay.
the issue, but we want to make sure. So,
all
Mr.
Right.
Ula?
I want to make sure this is what you had in mind.
Okay.
Sort of on page 1, line 19, after the word current, insert the word environmental. Then on page 1, line 21, after deposited, insert, quote, comma, provided that the facility is, and then pick up on your amendment, the first line there, located in a community that meets all the following conditions.
Okay.
Take it down to the end, and on line 115 of your the A3 amendment, delete that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And I'm sorry for the lack of communication there, apparently, about that.
No problem. And so we will, I will move that amendment. Again, it is to, on line 1.19, place the word environmental between current and pollution. And after deposited on line 1.21, put in parentheses, provided that the facility is, and then insert the language from the A3 amendment.
That's right.
Is that correct? Okay. And also strike line 1.15.
That's right.
Does everybody understand the amendment? And again, this is to get the bill in the form that the author would like. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor, I once again move the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, to illustrate some of the cumulative kind of issues that we're talking with here, I worked with our GIS folks here. I could give a map to you that shows how one layer upon another layer upon another layer in terms of asthma, childhood lead poisoning, some of the issues that we're talking about, the poverty and other environmentally sensitive issues work out in this built neighborhood. And so, Mr. Lee Mueller is going to just briefly run through that. And you all have a packet in front of you. Mr. Chairman, we can do this pretty quickly. I do want to hear some people from the neighborhood who I really want to have a little bit of time to discuss. So this will be quite brief, but I'm trying to illustrate to folks that we can map cumulative issues, and we do it right here in our own state office building.
Okay, and Representative Osmond has a question before we continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either for the author or for staff, is that when we're talking about, in this particular section, 116.07 subdivision 4A, is the term permits there, does that deal with all permits issued by Minnesota Pollution Control Agency or a specific category of permits?
Mr. Elas.
Reading meaning the language of current statutes appears to apply to all permits.
Yeah.
That's a PCA issue.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, that's a pretty big net. It hits all the mom and pop shops as well as, you know, right straight on up through when you're talking about all MPCA permits. I'm wondering if you're according to your maps, are targeting a specific location on your amendment on lines 1.2 instead of located in a community. You may I'd like you to consider putting in there located in a city of the first class. At least that way you're only driving businesses out of the city of the first class, not impacting everybody throughout the state of Minnesota, maybe totally unintended in your action. Because it's some of your criteria here is could hit a small pocket here or there. We wouldn't have any idea in this committee that was going to be the outcome.
Okay, and Representative Clark, did you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, we did clarify in line 1.19, we're talking about environmental pollution, not other kinds of pollution. I don't have a problem tightening up what you're talking about. What we're talking about in this bill is a very specific community. That's why I have it drawn so carefully. I'm not trying to take on the whole state of Minnesota or anything actually beyond a particular community at this point in time, because we have an urgent situation now with proposed a wood burner that could cause additional burden on the environmental health of the people in the community. So that's my intention. I don't have a problem with inserting a city of the first class, because my intention is to deal with one neighborhood in a certain city of the first class. If you want to do that, I'm such a friendly amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Clark. And Representative Cornish, did you have a question or comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, my concern was with just permits, but I see how small the area is. I was just wondering if it meant it doesn't look like we're running into gun ranges, racetracks, feedlot permits, everything else that they would ever deal with in this small area, I suppose, then.
Yeah. Representative Clark.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's very limited.
Any other discussion of the, and it's considered a friendly amendment?
I can incorporate that, Mr. Chairman, into the amendment.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Osmond.
I appreciate it.
So we will have that incorporated, and again, the amendment is on line 1.2 of the amendment, of the A3 amendment, to strike community and insert the word city of the first class.
Ms. Cannon, would you like us to go forward? Oh, you have to vote on the amendment. Excuse me.
Okay. Yeah, and I was informed that we do have to adopt the amendment, and we do have to vote on it. So, is there any discussion on Representative Osman?
I'd make that motion.
Representative Osman moves the oral amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Clark.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Mr. Miller just briefly to run through this document that you have. And it does show, as I indicated, he'll show it to you, how one set of conditions piles up on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, and that's how we get to the neighborhood. And so I hopefully we can do this pretty quickly so you can just see what these papers that you have in your desk need.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Miller, if you could state your name, please.
My name is Lee Miller. I'm at the LCC GIS office. As you see on the monitor, there's a dates map showing the Hennepin County Phillips neighborhood, and it represents the area that we're discussing. What you'll see is a series of scenes, and in the first scene, you'll see it's population percentages by age group. And as you page through each scene, you'll see the arsenic points come up on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And the following map will show the childhood elevated blood lead level. And this scene repeats for a variety of data sources. Here it's overlaid on the asthma data. Again, you'll see concentrations of asthma hospitalizations. And then you'll see the arsenic points placed on top of that data. And then the elevated blood lead levels. And this repeats for a variety of data sources. Here it's done by housing values with the arsenic and elevated blood lead levels. And then per capita income. percent minorities, that's the next group. Again, same basic layers, the arsenic data points and the elevated blood lead levels. That's it, Mr. Chair.
And what I wanted to show is that it is possible to understand the cumulative impact, and we can do it through mapping. I have someone from the neighborhood I'd like to have testify, Mr. Chairman, who lives just down the street from where this proposed facility is. Mr. Little is the United States. I actually have two people here, and they will just speak very briefly from as one member.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Lori Ellis. I chair the resident council at Little Earth. I'm old there when I was a teenager. My generation didn't know what asthma was. Now I have a teenage daughter with asthma. I have three grandchildren with asthma. One of my grandsons has been repeatedly hospitalized with asthma. Our community is overburdened as it is. I think it would be unconscionable for this body to allow more pollution to be put into our community.
Okay.
And I just had another person come up to sit here and get any questions, but at your request, we're not going to ask some of the people who did come just by. But let me just tell you that there are people in the neighborhood from several different parts of the community that are willing to testify. And so if there's any questions, fine. If not, then
sure. Yes, and if there are any questions, and I thank all those members that came to speak. We do have a number of bills on the agenda today. So, but any questions for the testifiers or for Representative Clark? Okay, seeing none. Okay, we will have to make one minor change in the oral amendment, and I will offer an oral amendment. Looking at the amendment, line 1.2, where we inserted located in a city of the first class, we need to insert community before city. Located in a community in a city, so you have to put, again, located in a community in a city of the first class. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to say a few words about the bill. When we first looked at this bill, I was initially planning to come here and tell you that it really wasn't necessary because we're doing this kind of analysis already. There was a court decision a couple of years ago that made it very clear that whenever a project goes through environmental review, we need to look at the cumulative impacts of the air emissions from that facility. And that's what's happening. The process is working. That's what's being done on this facility that Representative Clark mentioned earlier. But there are some other issues here. That the changes that she's made narrow the scope of this bill. But first, I would like to say that we remain very much concerned about environmental justice issues, and we believe that a full analysis of impacts needs to be done before we can move to completing environmental review and permitting a facility. But the kind of analysis that's being done here after talking with Representative Clark this afternoon is a different analysis than what we are trying to undertake. it's a multi, from what I understand, she wants a multimedia cumulative risk analysis, and I'm not sure that we know how to do that, and I can't tell you tonight that we know how to implement this bill, and I think that we need to talk to the Department of Health before we can even say how long it would take us to figure out how to implement this bill, and I think I'll just leave my comments at that.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark, would you like to respond?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I absolutely do not just care about what's in the air, but that's why we showed you the map, so we have children with childhood lead poisoning. It's what's in the soil. We have arsenic all over the ground. It is a multimedia issue, and I do expect this agency to work with the Department of Health. And in fact, for years I've asked them to do that, and I think that's, you know, that's inherent in what we're talking about here. There's nothing mysterious or unusual about it. Those agencies should be working together, and I think if they work together, they can accomplish this cumulative diagnosis that we're asking for now.
Any other comments? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I know your bill is pretty narrowly drawn. Would this include St. Paul as well? Or?
Mr. Chairman, not at this point. I decided to try to do one very specific community at this point, and I think I'd be willing to work with you or anybody else who wants to carry forward this kind of analysis in other areas. I decided to take one small bite, one small step, and see if we couldn't demonstrate environmental justice, how to make it work. And I am very happy to make it work in various parts of our state and other parts of our cities as well. In this area, I don't think it applies to St. Paul unless there is some community in St. Paul that has all of these criteria that are here. I'm not aware of if there is.
Representative South.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'm kind of concerned I believe we might have a facility that might to this rock pan. I know that's a big issue. I don't know if that might be part of this or not. If it is, I have an amendment might be ready, but go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, it is not. I do not believe that there is a Superfund site there. I don't really know very much about that particular project, but what we're trying to deal with here is, again, where there's an EPA Superfund site, where there's a majority of people of color, where there's a majority of low-income people, where there's a disproportionate impact of asthma, childhood lead poisoning, and so on. Unless you're telling me that community has all those things, it would not apply to them, and I don't think it does it?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I still haven't received a full confidence that St. Paul might not be part of it, so I got an oral amendment I want to move to exempt St. Paul from this as well, just in case goes any farther. I would like the St. Paul folks to get a handle on this. I believe after the city of the first class, I would like to add, except for city east of the Mississippi River.
Okay. Representative Powell, if you could repeat that.
After city of the first class, add except for a city east of the Mississippi River.
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with that. As I mentioned, I'm trying to really focus this.
Okay. Sure. And yes, and first, maybe I'll repeat the amendment very quickly here again. That would be line 1.2, after city of the first class, insert except for a city east of the Mississippi. Okay. Representative Dale.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think that we're narrowing down the scope of the bill here, which is fine. I'm thinking, though, that isn't a part of St. Paul on the west side of the Mississippi River as well? I don't know the town that well, where the boundaries are, but I'm pretty certain it is. So I was thinking, if Representative Clark really wanted to narrow this down, why not just make it a city of a first class in Hennepin County? And well, that way we don't have to have the exceptions.
Well, and I know, Representative Powell, your main concern with Rock Pen,
right,
which would be on the east side. But I suppose the problem with the definition maybe is that east of the Mississippi,
possibly,
it could include St. Paul if it's west.
Mr. Chair, maybe I would withdraw that amendment and go with Representative Jill recommends city of the first class in, city of the first class in Hennepin County. So add in Hennepin County.
Okay, we will then change the amendment to a city of the first class in Hennepin County.
Right.
Okay. Any discussion to that amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Any further discussion to the bill as amended?
Support, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of, I will again renew the motion that House File 3293 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Clark. And Representative Truman. Yes, we're going to have a question. Let us pass to the floor. Yes. Welcome, Representative Coonan, and I will move House File 2998 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also, there is an amendment that I would like to have moved, amendment to the bill. That's the AOA 1242 amendment.
And I will move the AOA 1242 amendment to get it in the shape and form that Gotham would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Coonan to the bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'll talk a little bit about the change the amendment made. The original bill would have set up a lifetime permit for permanently and totally disabled veterans to enter state parks and recreation areas. And to simplify the whole process and also cut the cost out of it, what the amendment does is offer free entrance for permanently and totally disabled veterans. And what the veterans would have to do is bring along the determination letter and show that when they're entering the state park, and then the permit fee would be waived, and the veteran would be able to get into the park then that way. This bill was brought to Senator Kubley and I by Tom Crayman from Renville, Minnesota. He was unable to be here today. He was here for the hearing on this bill in the Senate yesterday, but making the four-hour drive again today was going to be kind of a hardship, so he asked me to present the bill to the committee and to say a few words on his behalf. He's a member of Disabled American Veterans, a member of the American Legion, member of Benevolent and Protective Order of Elk, where he holds the position of Minnesota Chairman of the National Veterans Service Commission, and he's a volunteer service representative at the VA Medical Center in St. Cloud. And I think the main point that he wanted me to deliver to the committee was that through his work with those organizations, he believes in a strong believer in recreational therapy, and that's a treatment utilizing leisure activities to diminish or eliminate disabling conditions. And also he wanted me to emphasize to the committee that disabled vets, for the most part, have limited incomes, and so this would remove a barrier for access to state parks.
Thank you, Representative Coonan. Are there any questions? Thank you. Seeing no questions, I will renew the motion that House File 2998, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee members.
Thank you, Representative Coonan. And we will move on to Representative Dietrich next. Welcome, Representative Dietrich, and I will move House File 3292 be recommended to pass in the Committee on Finance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. House File 3292 addresses the fiscal management and legislative oversight of the school trust fund, and it expands the permanent school fund advisory committee as well as it redefines the committee. Before I go on to the bill, I'd like to just give you a little bit of background. And although as I'm looking around this room and thinking maybe you don't need the background, I'm used to presenting this in education circles, and most of us education folks are a little bit surprised about some of the school trust plans that we're learning. But anyhow, just in case there are any of you who don't know, when Minnesota became a state, the federal government granted land to townships out of every county to be held in a trust, which was to be invested to, as the Constitution says, to be invested to secure the maximum return to benefit the school district of the state of Minnesota into the future, forever. The DNR has been given the trust to manage these lands in the form of forest, predominantly in the forestry and mineral land. It is the State Board of Investment to invest the net income produced from the land and annually distributes the proceeds to the school district. And I believe you're all being handed out a flow chart type of thing, so you can kind of, just for your own information, see some of the flow of how that money flows from one fund to the other. And then we have, in statute, we have identified the State Board of Investment, and they are to invest the net income, and I already just said that, I'm sorry. It is the School Permanent Fund Advisory Committee, who is made up of legislators and educators, and they are charged in statute with overseeing the DNR's management of the school trust fund lands. It was in the interim, this past legislative before this legislative session started, Senator Reeder found himself a member of that school fund advisory committee. And as a result, he called a group of people together to go up there and be guests of the DNR and to tour the school trust lands and learn how all of this, how the school trust lands were managed, and then how the money all flowed and the different responsibilities of the DNR as the trustee. I was the chair of the school trust lands work group, and so I went up there with Senator Weger. It was very enlightening, very impressive, and I guess I don't have to tell you that because this is the Environment Committee, but the work of the DNR was extremely impressive. And as a result of that trip up north, there were several bills discussed that have resulted from that trip, and House File 3292 is one of those. And then after we returned from the trip up north, we talked more about school trust lands, and we really wanted to delve further into this to see if the school trust lands were actually maximizing the maximum amount of revenue that possibly could be. And as I researched the topic, I looked into the 1998 Legislative Auditor's Report. And you have copies of that, of those four documents in your packet, I believe. They look like this. This is the one I'll refer to first. this one is an executive summary. And I'd like to point out and the legislative auditor's report, the bottom two bullets under the recommendation. The first bullet says the legislature should require the DNR to report regularly on the school trust land management. Fourth bullet says the legislature should consider constitutional and statutory changes to maximize the fund's future growth. And then, the next, I'd like to point, refer you to the summary, the legislative auditor's summary. And in the second paragraph, the last line, it reads, but we think that the DNR should consider the possibility of assigning specific staff responsibility for coordinating school trust land activities within the department. And then I would also like to point your attention to the legislative auditor's report, and James Noble writes in, looks like this, I think you have it in your packet, in the second paragraph, second to the last line, the legislature, which has not always given consistent direction to the DNR on trust fund issues, could benefit from better information and analysis from the DNR. And then the last is the former finance commissioner and legislator, Wayne Seminole. He writes in his letter in regards to the legislative audit, in point number 3 on the front page of his letter, that permanent staff for the advisory committee using permanent school fund resources might be an option. Well, the concerns that were brought up in that legislative audit were concerns that I had also come to conclude. So what, like I said, there were a couple of pieces of legislation involved from this new information that at least I had. And so as I mentioned before, you have the bill before you. And so what I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, is now go through the bill and see, so that point out how this bill addresses the concerns of the legislative auditor and what we think will also benefit schools.
Proceed, Representative Beecher.
Okay, in section 1 of the bill, just to highlight 3 things. It gives the DNR commissioner the authority and the responsibility for administering the school permit school fund. As we talked about this, the school trust lands with the DNR, what became very clear to us is there's a lot of people in the DNR that know a lot about the school trust lands. But there is, and there are many people who are experts, but we, the legislature, don't have a go-to person. And the DNR continually told us that it is the commissioner that is the person ultimately responsible. And so we wanted to make that relationship very clear. Secondly, Section 1 of the bill directs the commissioner to report annually to the school's fund advisory committee on maximizing the permanent school fund revenue. That in the past has not been done regularly, and I think that you saw in the auditor's report that would benefit in the school trust lands and the fund if we had more regular communication with the DNR on that. And then thirdly, it directs the commissioner to designate an existing permanent professional staff person with certain charges, and you can read those within the bill, that makes and it also makes that person a non-voting member of the permanent school fund advisory committee. So that is section 1 of the bill. If you go on to section 2, it adds House and Senate K-12 finance and environment chairs and 5 individuals with specified areas of expertise appointed by the DNR. And so what we have done is we have expanded the advisory committee to include citizens, people from the community with expertise in areas to provide more conversation about how we can maximize the revenue from the school trust land. Another point that I'd like to make about section 2 is that it does direct the committee to annually submit a report and draft legislation to the legislature on managing the school trust lands to, once again, to secure the long-term economic returns on the trust lands. The other thing that I like to point out in Section 2 is that it requires the committee's annual report to make recommendations for improving the DNR efficiency, reducing management expenses, accelerating land transfers, and maximizing economic returns. So that is the bill. And Mr. Chairman, I can answer questions, or if you would like me to go to my testifiers, and then we can take questions afterwards, it's up to you.
Representative Hoppe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dietrich, maybe Mr. Meyer or your other testifier can answer this, but is there a cost associated with this bill? And I maybe that's in here and I didn't see it. Is there a funding mechanism and money for DNR staff or anything? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe, no, there is not going to be a cost to the bill.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, just to clarify that, we're working with the author to reduce any fiscal impact that may be there. It's like an existing permanent professional staff person. We did amend that. One thing that we do need to clarify is any compensation for advisory committee members for mileage and such that would be eligible under 15.059. We're hoping to have an amendment drafted to the finance committee when that issue is brought up there. This issue is brought up there.
That was... Commissioner Meyer,
sorry, from the record, Bob Meyer, to speak to Dina.
Senator Hill, did you have a question?
Well, I did. I can't find it. I can't find it.
Do you want me to stall for a minute?
They got it. Got it. Thank you. I'm sorry, I was outside. Mr. Chair, in the online one point, I think it's on 1.13. I think you were talking about the professional. The permanent professional employee. I heard just some talk about compensation or a fiscal cost on that. If you had a permanent employee, wouldn't you charge that? How would that get paid for? That permanent employee. Did you already address this, Representative Dietrich or Commissioner Meyer?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will begin to address it, is that when you start looking at the expenses for managing the school trust lands, the DNR has a process, a certification process, that they can charge back the expenses for managing the lands. And there are a multitude of employees that are all engaged in managing these school trust lands. And it is my belief is that there are many people already doing many different jobs very responsibly and ethically and doing their best to maximize the revenue. So what the commissioner is going to need to do is just consolidate and move some people and get the same amount of expenses just in a different way.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of questions here. First, I would just like to mention, looking in the overview, it says the DNR, this is regarding the legislative auditor's report.
Which,
Where the DNR sometimes emphasizes natural resource management responsibility over fiduciary responsibility to public schools, which are its beneficiaries. I am curious as to who decides what's more important, you know, with resource management versus, you know, for the long-term resource management. How will that be addressed? Because it might, you know, generate a fair amount of revenue if, for instance, clear cutting was done on a piece of property. However, you know, that would be a very short term. It wouldn't necessarily be resource management. Based, and I'm just curious about how much of this bill is going to have an override to the natural resource management versus funding for the school, and I would want to see that was balanced and so that the resource could be managed for whatever it would be, whether it would be spruce budworm or some other kind of disease that comes in and needs to be managed so that it works with contiguous property, whether that may be owned by DNR or perhaps county or private land, in case one needed to do that. So I just have a little concern that fiduciary responsibilities might override. Are we talking long-term or short-term? If you could address that, either Representative Dietrich or Deputy Commissioner. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, again, for the record, Bob Myers, Mr. DNR. Representative Taylor, you need to start in 127.8.31, which talks about the purposes of the permanent school trust fund, school trust lands, and the commissioner's responsibilities, which says we must manage these lands not only for economic return, but with sound natural resource and conservation principles. It's the DNR's main goal, the primary goal, is fiduciary responsibility and also statutory responsibility as related to the trust. You bring up a good question, though. Mining, timber harvesting, we need to balance those activities. I think what this committee will allow us to do is present those activities to them and then have those things weighed out. This committee probably remembers when we discussed our biennial budgets or other things, we talked about the three circles: recreation, economic sustainability, and conservation. You know, some of these lands may have more economic growth than recreational growth or sustainability growth, and those are the things that we need to talk about and educate members of the School Trust Advisory Committee on what those balances are. I envision this group spending some time looking at a lot of forestry activities, exploring mining activities, potential for new mining operations, and talk about what is the short-term and the long-term picture for the state.
Representative Taylor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question that follows along with that, what do you have provisions already within the advisory group about existing recreational uses? When I think about some of the school trust fund lands around the state that may have, you know, I'm talking about maybe grandfathering things in, because if you consider uses that may be occurring at this point or may have been something that's been used, that land has been used for the last 20, 30, 40 years or more, but is not necessarily generating a high rate of return, although it is still generating some return, what will happen to those uses? Will they be kicked off that piece of property, even though they've been there for quite a while and state financial resources have been put into those? Is there anything in any provision for that in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, I think those are specifics that this bill does not go into. For example, and I'll just refer to your question before, but it's on page 2, line 2.27, it says to secure the long-term economic return for the school permanent school fund, and that is the point of everything that we would want to have done, is to make sure that there is a long-term economic benefit. So it's always, so I'll just leave it at that. I mean, some of the things that you're talking about, I'm not an environmentalist, I'm not a, so I don't, it's just much more specific than the scope, than what this bill is designed to do.
Mr. Chair, if I could just give an example that maybe would help with that. If, for instance, a recreational trail crossed that property, would this bill then require that recreational trail be removed from the property, be it snowmobile, ATV, skiing, hiking, whatever, any kind of a grant and aid trail? Would that remove that from this kind of property, or would that be something that would be within the scope of the committee? But I'm just wondering, because it's probably more than, there are a number, I would guess, of these pieces of property, that are school forests that have some other uses that might not be, at the top of the list, just because historically they have been used that way. So I feel that that's an issue that needs to be dealt with. Will there be a clause grandfathering goes in, or, dealing with it in some other manner? But I just would like to know if that is going to be addressed. Maybe the Deputy Commissioner could address that.
I would just like to say one thing first, and that is that the advisory committee is already set up in statute, and they are to advise the DNR on the usage of the land. And in the Constitution, Minnesota State Constitution, we are directed
to maximize the long-term financial benefit of the land. So we've got what the rub here is that we've got complementary interests, and yet sometimes conflicting interests, and sometimes just plain and simple dual interests, I guess is the simpler way to say that. But that is the reason for the advisory committee, and that is why we have also added people in the advisory committee with an environmental background. We do want, within this advisory committee, to be asking questions, to be challenging, because we do feel like we have to, the legislature, and especially the folks in education, do need to do a better job of watching those lands and the return on them. And it isn't just also about the lands, it is also about the return on the school trust fund itself. So, and I think Mr. Meyer does
want to comment. Mr. Meyer. Chair members, Representative Taylor, you do bring up some good points to some of the issues we've worked on in the past. Had they been on school bus lands, it would have been a little bit different. I'm thinking of the Wilton Hill issue, for example. Other states charge access fees for this. Arizona comes to mind where they have a fee that all licenses of $1 or $2, I don't know exactly what it is, for people who are utilizing those lands, providing revenue to the trust fund lands. Those are some ideas that probably will be discussed by this group, but you do bring up a good point. How do you deal with recreation versus economic gain? And it's something that we deal with every day at the department. But those issues would be vetted in this group. You'll see they're adding on lines 2.26, one person with an expertise in forestry, one person with expertise in minerals and mining, one person with expertise in real estate development, one person with an expertise in renewable energy, and one person with an expertise in finance and land management. So we're trying to figure out and work with the group to look at new ideas and entrepreneurial ways on how to make more revenue, how to gain a better return, as some people want to look at it, for land, but also still maintain those lands as their resource benefits, conservation benefits as well.
Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair and maybe to Deputy Commissioner. I guess, you know, I recognize that we have some things that are, you know, some of these pieces of property that are already impacted, shall we say, by various recreational uses. And, you know, I would just not want to see some of those things really basically kicked off, you know, that piece of land, and yet we do need very much to make sure that we are, you know, generating the revenue that we need. And I appreciated your remarks about, you know, the Arizona paying a couple of dollars user fee, and I think that the State Grant and Aid Trail Fund actually does do that, if I'm not mistaken. They do pay into that. But so what kind of occurs, it was brought up that on line 1.12, advisory committee on ways to maximize the revenue generated. I'm wondering if we could maybe balance it, at least with regard to, you know, with regard to pieces of property that currently have other recreational uses that could, you know, present a problem. They may or may not, but because if this directs us to maximize the revenue generated, that might mean that some of these current uses on certain specific plans, I think you know where I'm going with this. At any rate, I'm just concerned about the directive to maximize on all of that, you know, and maybe use the word balance, or take into account the fact that there may be some pieces of property that need to be treated a little bit differently, or at least, you know, take into account current usage.
I would just like to, I don't know if you have, I thought you have a summary of the different statutes in your packet. And I would just like to emphasize that it is in the Constitution that those land, that we are supposed to maximize the amount of revenue for school trust funds. I mean, if that isn't new, and we wouldn't necessarily be doing anything different, that is in the state constitution.
Okay, and hello, Representative Hackbarth. Okay, Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not comfortable with the direction that Representative Saylor is headed down, because let me give you some examples. It is very common to have a snowmobile trail across the school trust land, and under that land are millions upon millions of dollars of minerals that are a lot more valuable than having a snowmobile trail across the top of the land. So what I hear you suggesting is that we're in a sense grandfathering. You're suggesting to grandfather in, let's say, a hiking trail for that matter. Let's not use motorized. A hiking trail. And then the lands and minerals is doing their part to maximize the return on investment, which is their charge under the Constitution, discovers that there is a platinum metal group under there. Platinum, let's just use as an example the Polymet proposed mine or the Birch Lake mine. I think Birch Lake mine has school trust land. And so now that billions of dollars worth of metal is being proposed to mine, and if we do something that's headed down your line of thinking, as I understand it, we'd be weighing the snowmobile trail or the agent. Now you know that I support those kind of things to the mat. But from time to time you have to make a decision that's based on the Constitution of this state. And that says that they'll maximize. And so I'm afraid that if we start to water that down or try to water, we may not even be able to water it down because of the fact that it's in the Constitution. I mean, something like that could be challenged. For example, the school could come forward and file a lawsuit and say, you didn't do your fiduciary job. You didn't do it. You found all those minerals. You found all that gold. You found all that platinum. You found all that copper, zinc, nickel. And you left it down there for the sake of a hiking trail or a biking trail or a horse trail or whatever, for the fact that you want to just keep the timber growing on it, which is a much lesser value than all those minerals. So I understand where you're going with that, but I think that we're on shaky ground when we start to look at that and try and play with the intent of the Constitution.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair, and I would just like to mention to Representative Dill that actually I was thinking a lot more about Aspen than I was about platinum. and I certainly take your remarks into account, but I actually was thinking, like I said, Aspen.
Well,
thank you,
Mr. Chair,
and Representative Dill.
And I really wasn't being critical. I'm just trying to say that the Range delegation is really intimately knowledgeable about trust lands, particularly myself, because most of them are in my district to start with, because everybody else sold off their trust land, you know, so they could homestead that land. And so we're blessed with all that wonderful resource, and we certainly, as a Range delegation, we want to do our best to maximize that so the kids in Mankato and Worthington and Roseau and so on and so forth, yeah, and Bemidji and all those places get the money out of it. And with that, I had another item, Mr. Chair. Okay. I'm a little goosey on line 1.13 when it comes to the fact that it says, now, first off, I just made my speech about the fact that, you know, I want to maximize the return. And, I mean, Rukavina has been, like, on this for however long, 20-some years that he's been in the legislature, 20-plus. I'm a little goosey on this line 1.13 and follows where it says, the commissioner shall designate existing professional permanent staff whose duty shall be blah, blah, blah. They already have that. I mean, they've got Marty Vadas who lives and breathes this stuff, and they had Bill Bryce before that. And so I'm just thinking, and for the sake of discussion, if you thought about it in terms of this, and I'm not proposing an amendment yet, I'm just bringing this out if I can, Mr. Chair, to discuss. Then on line 1.3, what we really want them to do, as I understand it, is to accelerate land exchanges, land sales, and commercial leasing of school trust land, and to manage the lands to maximize the long-term economic return to the permanent school trust. And that's what it says in the bill, but it gets that employee business thrown in the front of it, and that's micromanaging. I mean, that's micromanaging. They should be able to use, you know, to have some latitude. What we need to do is order them in this bill to do exactly what this bill just said, is to accelerate the land exchanges, line 1.4 through 1516, and take out the part about designating personal staff and let them fit a professional staff and a designated person. And then down in lower, down in 1.17, it should say, rather than the permanent professional staff position shall be responsible for serving as, it should say the commissioner shall designate a person to serve as a non-voting member of the Permanent Advisory School Trust. And I know that was a lot to put on the plate in one shot, but I just think that would give them some more latitude, knowing that we're not too happy with the way they've been doing it, and knowing that this bill then tells them they better get off their duff and get something done. And that this more, I think, represents the way that I thought that you guys were going to go. And I love the fact that you did all this and that you guys got all this. But it's just an idea, so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. You represent Dale, I do believe that's probably the intent, but you think it's not the language that's
used
often.
I just feel like it's micromanaging them, that it says that they must. I mean, you don't, Mr. Chair, they don't say, we don't say in law, I don't think we do, or maybe Mr. Meyer can comment on this. We don't tell them that you must have a director of you must have a permanent full-time position person in the director of trails and waterways or the director of fish and wildlife to maximize the benefits of wildlife. It's just going. I just think it doesn't really get to the intent. The intent is to get them to do it, and so that's the point.
Okay, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Representative Gill. I'm really liking this conversation. The intent is twofold. It is to get them to do those things, and it is also to have a person at the DNR that this advisory committee can talk to, in the annual meeting and with the annual recommendations, and yet in between that, and I think the auditor's report came out pretty clear that we need to have better communication. They said it differently. But I very much respect what you're saying, and I would like to think about that a little bit longer and do some revisions and see how we can work together on that. I would love to work with you on that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dale.
And thank you very much for that, Representative Dietrich. Can I hear from Mr. Meyer? Who would you appoint to this position? I'm not saying the person. I'm not saying, Joe Blow. I'm talking about the person at your staff. It already says that you must appoint designate an existing permanent professional staff person. Well, I can't imagine it being anybody other than the Director of Lands and Minerals who already does all of that. But let's hear from you.
Mr. Chair, members, we have been discussing this, and most likely it would be Marty Bates, Director of Lands and Minerals position. The commissioner does have the authority and responsibility for these lands right now, and if you look in 97A, 84, 97C, the commissioner has the authority. He's given the powers. It doesn't say the director of fish and wildlife or this or that. In our earlier discussions in this bill, it was that you need to have somebody who's accountable. Executive, legislative branches. The commissioner is ultimately responsible to the governor and to the legislature. So, in looking at this language, we would ultimately designate probably Marty Bates to be the person. And somebody like him, maybe Kathy Lewis, I'm not sure who it would be. And then we would work on how that position would, the staffing of the committee would be a little bit different. We've staffed the committee in the past. We wrote the report. And honestly, the attention on these lands, probably Representative Bill, as you know, comes and goes. The Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee would meet for a while, they wouldn't meet. So it's good to put more people on here and talk about how to do this now, but it's just that ongoing interest is what you need. And it's the way it's staffed. We've staffed the committee in the past. We wrote the report, made recommendations, so we do those things right now. It's just that constant attention is, I think, what the author and school board association is looking to describe for.
And, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dale.
And if you had, and later, and just as again for discussion, I would change on 1.7 something like this, 1.17, the commissioner shall designate a person to serve as a non-voting member. I think that then that would get you the communication. Probably is going to be the very same person that they have working on this, so that would get the communications. They would then be on the on the advisory committee, and then later in the bill on page 3 it says the non-voting member of the advisory committee shall work with the committee to prepare the annual report. So I mean, you've got that all tied in there. It's all tied in together. Plus, it gives you the boot in the backside to get something done. So you know, where's the next stop for this bill?
Ms. Chair.
Environment finance.
Oh, Representative Loganius.
Environment finance, yes, Representative Loganius.
I'm not satisfied they don't need to hear it since there is no fiscal note.
I'm not sure that there isn't a fiscal note if they have to assign personnel to do this. But I'd like to hear from Representative Loganius. I'm not lobbying for or against the note, but I'm just thinking that I'm learning from Representative Loganius not to send the bill out unless it's the way it should be, but if it's getting to her committee next, I'm then really comfortable in that we can work on this between Representative Dietrich and Representative Loganius, myself and Mr. Meyer, and get it. If we make a change, it can get done then. So I guess I'd like to hear from her if she's going to ask for the bill.
Yeah. And Representative Loganius is shaking her head. Yes. Did you want to comment? Okay. Yes.
And one thing,
Representative Dietrich.
And again, thank you, Representative Dietrich. I'm not being critical. I'm just trying to make a better bill. I love the idea. This started when I came in the legislature with Barb Sikora and Alice Segrin and them talking about doing just what you're doing. I'm glad that you've kept doing it.
You
should be a member of the Iron Range. If you get this done, you'd be an honorary member of the Iron Range delegation.
I'm working on it.
Have you? $200 dues, you're in. Just ask Junkie.
She got to learn to talk a little rougher, too. Representative Dietrich.
Representative Bill, I would like to continue this conversation, and we could talk about this. And I looked at it in the form of, you know, a business type of org chart. You know, you have to have one person, a go-to person, and your suggestion might accomplish that, and it might even get to the point a little bit faster than what we had intended. And I am very much interested in that. So I'd like to, for now, leave the bill as is. Is that what I'm hearing you also say would be fine with you, and then we can work on it together, and then when it gets to Representative Loganius' committee, we can possibly offer an amendment.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to just call on Grace Schwab, Minnesota School Board Association.
Sure. And we'll go to Ms. Schwab. I think Representative Scalzi had a question first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I did have a question. I think maybe not a question, but a comment. I think, and I typically have my Constitution with me, but I don't today. But I think in the language of the Constitution, the first time they used maximum on the first page of this, under number one, it's talking about the maximum the fund shall be invested to secure the maximum return consistent with the maintenance of the perpetuity of the fund. So we're talking about investment where that maximum, but then under number two, it talks about the maximum long-term economic return. Now, this is going to be a little different from the language of the bill, because under number two, then it says consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities, etc., with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. That's pretty specific. I mean, it doesn't say that you can clear cut it, and it doesn't, because we're talking about natural resource conservation and management principles, and I think if we were to go as far as this language, and I would hope that you'd change the language just a little bit, because we don't want to say to accelerate land exchanges, land sales, and commercial leasing if that doesn't fit in with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. We would change the constitutional language somewhat,
okay,
make it go in a different direction. So I would just comment maybe it's a little too strong and away from the constitutional language. That's just what comes to me at this point.
Representative Dietrich.
DNR can speak to that a little bit more, but some of these plans, these land exchanges and those types of things, have been the goals of the DNR for many, 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 many years.
Right.
And the part there are obstacles like getting the land assessed and those types of things. And so that was our goal in appointing, having one person work on these issues on a daily basis, that somebody was representing the school district, not from the standpoint of clear cutting or any dramatic wayward way from the intent of any of the statutes or the Constitution. But there are some of these things that the DNR has been talking about for a very long time. And we just thought it would be very beneficial to get citizen input and have somebody on the DNR on a regular basis, on a daily basis, returning to that school district piece of it and making sure that those goals are being accomplished at a timely fashion.
And I would just say that maybe as the bill travels through and you work through the language, you might turn a little bit to that constitutional language, just leave that clause in there so it's evident that we want to keep the school trust lands and we want to keep them in sound natural resource conservation and management principles. And I think if you added that, I would feel a lot better about it, but rather than stray from the Constitution.
Representative Dell.
That wouldn't be unilaterally correct either, in that we've sold hundreds of lakeshore lots that are school trust, made in exchange, sold them. We condemned our own land, 37,000 acres. The legislature condemned 37,000 acres of school trust land and put the money in the school trust when we formed Voyageurs National Park. It was from a general fund appropriation, as I remember. And so it wouldn't be universal that over history of school trust that we've kept the land, as you suggest, in perpetuity. Although I don't want to see them go away either, except I do want to get paid for the ones that are in the boundary waters.
I didn't mean to intend that the land sales was troublesome. Only the only thing that was troublesome was taking out the language of the sound natural resource conservation and management system. So I understand that we exchange and sell. I understand that.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Dietrich.
Okay, just a clarification, those words are not in the Constitution. So the footnote number one is the constitutional reference, and then on the page two, those are statutes.
I see.
Okay. And we'd like Ms. Schwab, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I represent Minnesota School District across the state. I just want to share some really good news and applaud you for taking this issue on. Representative Dietrich has been a leader in this area. Oregon itself has a natural resource protection chief in their constitution, and they have been able to see returns for their school district. So I know management of the lands with those principles truly can happen, and this topic has really been growing. In fact, Utah from 2001 to 2006 has been able to triple the revenues from their school resource lands. So it's really positive out there. I encourage you on your work. We'll be working with you all the way to a district representative working in this committee. But thank you for your diligence on this. It means a lot to those school districts.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Any other questions at all for testifiers or Representative Dietrich? Okay, I see none. Oh, thank you. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say to Representative Dietrich that I think that this is a good bill, and I hope that she doesn't think that I'm attacking it or our schools, or certainly not the whole concept that has been in place for so long of school trust land, because it is a wonderful way to work in, you know, our natural resources with our schools. I just wanted to raise that the issue of, you know, some of the other uses and, you know, what will happen, because sometimes, you know, the left hand doesn't always know what the right hand is doing and some of the other things that have been going on with some of these lands. But at any rate, lest you think that, you know, I would sell it all off and not have the schools. I just wanted to clarify that point as well as bring up those issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none. I will renew the motion, unless Representative Dietrich, do you have any final comments before we take the vote?
No, I would just like to say that I appreciate the time here, and I think that this bill, the only intent is to once again have increased the legislative oversight over the school trust lands, which I think we are entrusted to do as trustees in the Constitution and in statute. So I think we're doing our due diligence. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dietrich. I will renew the motion that House File 3292 be recommended pass to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Good evening, Representative
Gardner.
Mr. Chair, compared to the last couple bills and the one that's at the end of the program tonight, I think these will be a little bit simpler. Mr. Chair, I'd like to seek your advice about House File 2777 before I move it.
That would be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I realize that this money would take some, or this bill would take money out of the general fund, which I don't really think is in the cards this year, but I think it's important that the Environmental Finance Committee members see the bill.
I agree.
And I don't know if you would want to recommend this to pass without recommendation or with. I will take your advice on that, or just let's just keep moving as usual if you want.
We can recommend that it pass. And, yeah.
Very good. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2777, recommend to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves that House File 2777 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance. And Representative Gardner for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2777 would remedy an issue that has been kind of an irritant in those who have been involved with solid waste management, recycling, and so on for many years. We have a groundbreaking financing system for cleaning up old landfills and incentivizing recycling in Minnesota's counties through the Solid Waste Management Act and subsequent amendments, including the SCORE program, which was designed to filter money to counties to promote recycling. That is all funded by the Solid Waste Management Tax. And by statute, 30% of the solid waste management tax goes to the general fund and stays there. And 70%, after many versions of it, have gone to the environmental fund for a variety of remediation activities as well as prevention and recycling activities. This bill would actually just dedicate all of the solid waste management tax revenue to the environmental fund. And then I have some suggestions for where we could go with it, but realizing that this isn't this is going to be a difficult year, I'm not going to wordsmith all the particular uses. But I have a handout that actually shows, and I don't know if everybody's got it, the bar graph, two bar graphs, which actually shows the amount of funding that has come to counties to help support solid waste and recycling activities. Since the program's inception, and the county share of solid waste expenses has gone up while the state share has remained flat or actually declined when counting in inflation. On the bottom graph, you actually see where our recycling rates have gone in recent years, and they've flattened out. The next bill I have actually has suggestions for how we can improve that, and it's asking for goals and plans, but I think this bill might have some life maybe next year as some of the plans I'm laying out in the next bill come to fruition. But that was it. I don't know if anyone wants to testify on it, but if since the chances here are kind of slim, and since we have another complicated bill coming up, I guess I would leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
We do have a couple of people who would like to testify. We have Annalee Garlett. From the AMC. And if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief with my comments on this. We also acknowledge
we acknowledge the difficulties that are associated with this bill, but we do want to let Representative Gardner that we appreciate the attention that's been brought to this issue. We do want to bring this issue to the forefront. Counties have long had the policy that we support allocating 100% of the solid waste management tax to state and county product stewardship, household hazardous waste activities, and other waste management activities. And we see that starting this conversation and this bill is a step in the right direction. We support this effort and look forward to working with Representative Gardner and others on furthering this idea as we move forward. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you. And
my name is Randy Kaiser, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kaiser,
yeah. I'm here representing the Minnesota State Solid Waste Administrators Association. A couple of the points we'd like to point out about core funding that we think were important is that it was originally set at $15.5 million total in 1989. It is currently at $14 million. In all those years, we're obviously not getting any more money from growing community programs that have been growing. We feel that if we're adjusted for inflation at a modest rate, we currently be seeing $26 million appropriated for core funding. Some of the things to keep in mind, we believe there would be results from increased core funding. There's always new material to divert from the waste stream. We believe we could get more reduction in toxicity in the waste stream, and also be able to meet the goals expressed in further bills and further materials to be diverted will likely come before the legislative committee's discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Representative Lagunias has a question.
Not so much a question as a comment. I like the direction here and would hope sometime we can do what you're talking about. One of the things that might be helpful for this mission is to look at real numbers about how much of the greenhouse gas emissions you could reduce by raising the recycling rate. And
yes, to get a copy. So go ahead.
Well, the numbers that you all come up with, look at a couple of issues. How much greenhouse gas reduction you could do with higher recycling, with more composting, and less long-term trucking. And if you all can come up with some numbers like this, we know that we've got to meet some new and very aggressive goals. And that just would be helpful, I think, in the long run. Perhaps Representative Saylor would have a thought on that, too.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a matter of fact, I do. I appreciate this bill very much. I think that it is overdue, and at the same time recognizing the difficulties that we're facing with the state budget at this point, it may be difficult to do anything about it. However, I have had numerous conversations with county solid waste administrators and other folks and county commissioners and regarding the need for an increase in the amount of money that's going to the counties through the SCORE funding. And also I think that it would be a good time to recognize the fact that the waste stream has changed since, you know, it changes yearly. We keep adding more and more things that have to be dealt with. We come up with new studies. We understand further impacts that are happening to the environment and indeed to the humans and to everyone with regard to toxicity issues and others. So my point being the costs of dealing with solid waste have certainly gone up much more rapidly than our SCORE grants that would refer to the comments that Mr. Fisher?
Kaiser,
I'm sorry, excuse me, with regard to the $26 million, you know, if it were an inflation, index to inflation. So I would just add my comments to say that it's time to start taking a new look at, or another look at how we're funding the SCORE, because there's a definite need in the counties for some help with that.
And any further questions? Representative Gardner, any final comments before we...
Nothing, Mr. Chair, just renew my motion.
Yeah. Representative Gardner renews his motion that House File 2777 be recommended to pass the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And bill is passed. And Representative Gardner, to your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just got me 20 points on my minutes of the Fantasy Legislator League standings there, I think. Although it wasn't my intention. Mr. Chair, this is going to get a little complicated for a couple minutes as we do some housekeeping, but I'd like to have House File 3540 be recommended to pass and be recommended to the Committee on Energy.
Representative Gardner moves that House File 3540 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Energy. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a an amendment, the A1 amendment. And then after that, I have an oral amendment and a small technical amendment, which wouldn't need any action.
Okay.
I'd like to move the A1, the 3540 A1 amendment.
Okay, we'll start with the A1 amendment. Get it in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move an oral amendment to delete sections 9 through 11.
To delete sections 9 through 11. And again, this is to get the bill in the shape and form that the office would like. All those in favor of the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I have one typo. There actually is someone in the audience who read all the way to the second to last line in the repealer section. Line 13.29 of the original bill here. 13.29, it says subdivision 2, comma, R, and then it ends. And so if we could take a technical amendment to replace the comma with a period and remove the word R.
Okay.
Mr. Eloff wrote in
simple
ink at the end of it.
Okay. Representative Gardner, yes. Mr. Ula. Okay. So the word repeal?
Repeal.
I see. And Representative Gardner, we're told that you probably want to have the word repealed after the word R.
Yes.
I will abide by Mr. Eloff's reading of the bill.
Okay, the oral amendment is changed.
Yeah.
And Representative Gardner moves that on line 13.29, add the word repealed. And a period. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought what I would do is give you 30 seconds of background and then walk through the bill and take out your red pen so you can mark up the sections that just came out, if that's all right. Mr. Chair, I had worked in the recycling and composting industry for about 9 years before coming to the state legislature. I am no longer in that line of work anymore, but it was apparent after many successful years of implementation of the Solid Waste Management Act and various amendments that we had kind of flattened out in our progress, and climate change now has been a very compelling vision under which solid waste management now fits. The MTCA in its biannual solid waste policy report and the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board here in the metro area have actually put a lot of stakeholder groups together to help figure out how we can move forward to boost recycling, boost composting, and to reduce land disposal in particular. For all of the reasons that that has value to us. Therefore, this bill actually has a lot of some of those ideas. I've discovered that the ideas that didn't really have consensus are the ones that I came up with, and that's been deleted and amended. So there actually has been quite a bit of consensus around many of these items, and I have tried to have an open-door policy as I developed this bill in the late fall and early winter, and I did have an airing of this bill in Representative Saylor's working group just to get people to focus on it, give me ideas, language for particular changes that would make it more technically correct or tighter in its language and more clear in its intent. So that open door is now closed at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I've had people try and flag me down while I was just trying to go to the bathroom and little changes, and we're done with that for now. So I'd like to go through the bill a little bit to point out where we're going. Section 1 has to do with construction and demolition waste from state buildings. In talking with construction and demolition recyclers, they tell me that it is very easy, particularly in the metro area, to achieve a 40% recycling rate by weight when you take down a building or put a new one up. And after hearing from the Department of Administration, I changed the wording here a little bit and put it under the sustainable building statute in 15B. Section 2, 3, and 4 all have to do with breaking down some barriers we have to source separated organic materials. These are things that are made into compost that includes food waste, yard waste, and things like non-compostable paper, which makes up a significant amount of our municipal waste stream. The primary thing we need to do is actually remove source-separated compostable materials from the definition of mixed municipal solid waste. Now, that might sound like fighting words, Mr. Chair. I know we're too tired to chuckle at a little solid waste humor. But all in the recovery, Mr. Chair. And then the issue on reuse talks about how food has actually been reused in everything from food to people programs, where food is donated to nonprofit organizations, food to hogs. There are actually some prosperous hog farmers to the north of us who actually take a lot of food waste. And we also have materials reuse. That's another issue. But in Section 4, we further desegregate mixed municipal solid waste, which is what we commonly call garbage, from source-separated compostable materials, for those of you scoring at home. Section 5 includes some language about product stewardship. For those of you not familiar with the term, product stewardship is a process by which all parties having to do something with the production or management of solid waste has something to do with minimizing waste, reducing toxicity, and otherwise finding a better home for waste. This is the process that we use successfully that Representative Osmond and Representative Saylor used for electronic waste management, where all the stakeholders got together more or less and worked out a plan. There were obviously some divisions there, but ultimately that was the process that was used. Minnesota is also now a pilot site for another product stewardship program for paint. We pay as taxpayers several million dollars every year to safely manage oil and latex-based paint. And the Paint and Coatings Association, all the paint manufacturers, are working with the state and local counties here in Minnesota to do that. The reason that I'm asking for the definition of the principles of product stewardship is to speed up the process by which all these stakeholders for specific products understand what the rules of communication will be, so that we don't have to relearn the process all the time. And in Subdivision 2 of Section 5, I'm asking the Pollution Control Agency to present to the legislature recommendations for what a more comprehensive product stewardship approach would look like, and identify, along with stakeholder input, what type of management processes might be used for some of those things. The one product that I had in mind in looking at this was actually pharmaceuticals. I know that's a problem we have in our wastewater stream with endocrine disruptors, and some counties are actually already collecting unwanted pharmaceuticals to keep it out of the waste stream. So that is one of the key areas. Section 6 would require a solid waste characterization study. This is what we call a waste sort, where Gottman Tyvek just goes through the garbage at a transfer station, landfill, or waste energy facility. Some facilities, like the waste energy facilities, do this already every 5 years. There's nothing that would preclude the inclusion of this data into the statewide study. But this actually tells us what's in our garbage and how much, so that we can figure out how to best manage that waste in the future. Section 7, because of the author's amendment, that is now out. Section 8 relates to construction and demolition waste recycling in the Twin Cities, Seven County metro area. There is a burgeoning construction and demolition recycling industry. This is where you take waste that you have from putting up or taking down a building, and the material falls in a couple of basic categories: drywall, concrete, asphalt, wood, metal, and probably a few other things, but they often are collected together at a work site, taken to a facility that can then sort it out by machine and by hand. By getting an economy of scale here, by requiring that buildings that are going up or being taken down that are over 1,000 square feet, we would actually create greater economy of scale and help with the efficient collection and marketing of this material. And there are quite a few family-owned and locally-owned companies that do this already. And I think one of them may be here. I don't know if they're going to testify to the bill. Continuing, Section 9, 10, and 11 are out. It would have added a committee stop, and the confusion about what it would do and its benefit was a little bit too confusing, and I couldn't get it. And actually, this is my idea, so it's this is one of those. There was consensus that it didn't make any sense, so I'm taking it out. Section 12, materials used for composting. I have some props. This would actually extend what is already in ordinance in Dakota County to the rest of the Seven County metro area. We also have a burgeoning compost industry in Minnesota. There is no faster way to make new dirt than to compost compostable materials. The problem is that the way we often dispose of food waste, yard waste, and other material that goes to a compost site is with a polyethylene bag. So I will let you check out this lovely bag. This is what we don't want. Private businesses that would like to get in the, and expand compost businesses but cannot because the quality of the material that they're getting is so poor. Therefore, the idea that Dakota County has, which is to require only compostable bags, or I should say prohibit non-compostable plastic in yard waste and food waste collection programs, should be extended to Seven County Metro. This is what biodegradable bags look like. They just look just like plastic, and then you get this lovely compost, Mr. Chair. And I know a lot of people make fun of me for talking about compost. They assume I'm talking about manure, but in fact, this is food waste and yard waste. There is one Minnesota company, Cortec, which has a letter in your packet, based in White Bear Lake and with a manufacturing plant in Cambridge, which actually makes the bag. They and the folks at the, I think it's the Biodegradable Packaging Institute, have been talking to me about how to get more economies of scale to help reduce the cost of the bag, and also to increase, I see Representative Olson taking a good whip there. Thank you very much. We're trying to create more economies of scale. The author's amendment changes this section a little bit so that materials collected in the Seven County metro area, no matter where the material goes, are the areas that would have to use the bags. This does not mean you can't use a rolling cart in the Seven County metro, as I do at my house. It doesn't mean you can't use a paper bag. That is degradable and meets the ASTM standard here. And it doesn't mean that you can't take your big bag that you really like of your plastic bag, stick it in your truck, take it to the yard waste site, pour out the contents, and take the bag with you. No problem for that. But if you're going to put a plastic bag into that it ends up in a compost facility, you do have to you would have to have it to be compostable. I have a separate bill, because it would have to go to another committee, that would have some truth in labeling to make sure that there are not faux compostable bags sold in Minnesota, that they would actually have to be truly compostable. Section 13, this is an area where this is why it's going to the Energy Committee, and I, if it's all right, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that I've actually been talking to one of the utilities about tweaking this so that we make it consistent with other bills that involve SIP, but recycling actually conserves energy. I have some numbers here, but I won't take up a lot of time with it, but it takes less energy to make new stuff out of old stuff than it does to use virgin materials. For example, to make a new aluminum can, gosh, look, somebody threw an aluminum can in the garbage. Can you imagine? This uses, to make that out of an, recycled materials uses only 5% of the energy that you would use if you smelted down raw bauxite ore. Whole power plants in the Pacific Northwest have been built in past decades just to provide power for large primary aluminum smelters. Some of you may know of the Spectro Alloys in Rosemount. They're actually a secondary smelter. You don't hear of huge amounts of energy being used there compared to, say, a new aluminum smelter because they use aluminum scrap. And I have been talking to the utilities about what energy conservation benefits we would have by increasing our recycling rate for things like cans or bottles or paper, and they are a little tentative, but the language here is very permissive, and solid waste managers would have to show that there are quantifiable additional tons and savings in energy as a result of increasing recycling rates, and those would have to be presented and backed up. But I have some language that we're going to tweak in the Energy Committee to make that tighter and more consistent with other SIP ideas. Section 14 is now out. Section 15 is now out. Section 16 is now out. And Mr. Chair, here we come to the one that takes more time than it really should. It's on telephone directories. There actually is a phone book recycling statute on the books which says that publishers of the phone books have to take them back. That was all part of our recycling push about 15 years ago. The solid waste policy report put out by the Pollution Control Agency has a recommendation agreed to by all the stakeholders that in Minnesota you ought not to have a phone book unless you ask for it, that they shouldn't be distributed at all. Called an opt-in system. I disagreed with that politely because I don't want to be the guy who killed the phone book industry in Minnesota, but it did seem that if a consumer wants choice to not get a phone book, if you really don't want a phone book, that you should have that ability to do that. And I talked to the two largest phone directory publishers in the state about this, and they didn't like the idea of sort of like a do-not-distribute list through the state. And what I have here is essentially requiring those publishers to have their own do-not-distribute list. They don't have to share the data, but also publish very clearly what the steps are to be able to not get that. The Direct Mail Association has a thing like this that you can get off junk mail lists, but they didn't tell anybody about it. And so it's left to environmental advocates to let you know how you can get off junk mail lists. And so I just want to make sure through the author's amendment that we had language that said you must print this on the front of your directory. The other publisher, or the first publisher, said they were fine if we said use your own list, and the other one said we would just rather not have anything there and just use our own voluntary system. And the lack of enthusiasm in their opposition, I guess you could call it, led me to believe that they probably could live with this bill, but I don't know that for sure. Section 18, this would ask the PCA to develop a model ordinance for construction and demolition waste recycling. The PCA currently has a model ordinance for municipal recycling contracts, which several counties have used to help them maximize recycling and interact and increase efficiency in working with their contracted haulers. And I'm simply asking that they do the same for construction and demolition, and there are lots of good models out there. It does not require cities to use it. It just makes it available. And the effective date through the author's amendment has been extended, I think, till next year, because there's some solid waste rules being commented on and will go into force later this year. I wanted to wait till they went into force before we did this. Section 19 has changed because of the amendment. It's not a task force. It simply asks the Pollution Control Agency to look at the goals for recycling and composting that are in the Climate Change Advisory Group report, 60% recycling and 15% composting, and report to the legislature on how we would achieve those goals. Not setting the goals, but asking how they would be achieved and what the cost would be for that. Section 20 is out. Section 21 is just to renumber. And Section 22, Mr. Eloff and I worked on to find some of the more arcane statutes in the Solid Waste Management Act that no longer apply, and one of them in particular dealt with containment of hazardous waste facilities for things that were actually never built in Minnesota, and so they've never actually been used. And so that's what the repealer is for. Mr. Chair, that was it. Maybe I could answer some questions that people have on the technical detail, and I think we have some coming up also.
Well, thank you, Representative Gardner, and thank you for all the exhibits as well. So,
I'm here for you, Mr. Chair.
I'm glad you didn't bring manure, though. Thank you. We do have testifiers as well, but are there any questions for Representative Gardner before we continue on? Okay. We have Mr. Reed Lewis.
Glad the Beverage Association is taking care of the recycling issue.
Welcome, Mr. Reed. If you want to state your name, please.
My name is Reed Lewis. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Reed Lewis. I represent Broadway Resource Recovery and Atomic Recycling, two affiliated companies that specialize in recycling construction and demolition waste in the Penn County metro area. We are located approximately 3 miles north of the IDF building in downtown Minneapolis. The facility has 26 to 30 full-time employees. In 2007, Broadway Resource Recovery processed over 107,000 tons of commingled C&D waste. Of the 107,000 tons processed, we recycled over 67,000 tons, or 63% by weight, or the equivalent of 64 miles of dumpsters put end to end. In 2006, our facility processed and recycled more commingled construction waste than all other transfer stations and landfills combined in the Penn County metro area. The different commodities we recycle from the commingled waste stream are wood, steel, aggregate, cardboard, and C&D fines. C&D fines are a real material. It is not manufactured, but rather it is just material that is found at the bottom of a dumpster. I would like to point out that the state supports separation and reuse of these materials per Minnesota Statute 115A.02, which, among other things, requires separation and recovery of materials, and also clearly states that waste recycling is the preference of the state over landfilling waste. We also operate Atomic Recycling, the second largest fleet of roll-off dumpster trucks that collect the C&D waste from around the 10-county metro area and transport the waste back to our facility in Minneapolis for processing and recycling. One of the handouts is our company brochure. For the purposes of this hearing, please disregard the name on the brochure. Our brochure contains a substantial amount of educational material. Found on pages 4 and 5 are the current markets for recyclable waste, the construction and demolition composition of the Penn County metro area, and on page 7 you'll find the proper reporting with backup documentation, including driver tickets that's hauling the waste from the project and scale tickets showing how much waste was being hauled away to prove how much material was actually recycled. Our company starts by creating a construction waste recycling and management plan for a project. And that's found in one of the exhibits. The construction waste recycling management plan is a blueprint for identifying what types of materials will be recycled the required recycling percentage of the project, the list of different responsible parties for the waste on the project. After the project has started, we deliver to the developer, architect, or contractor a report, and that's shown in one of your handouts also. And the report shows the project name, it shows what's happening project to date, and for this month, or, and how it's outlined is it has on-site separation as well as off-site separation, which is material at our facility. We provide the construction waste management plan, reporting with backup documentation, the recycling of construction waste at no additional cost over landfilling. In fact, often it is much lower in cost. In closing, we'd like to extend an invitation to anyone from the state to tour our facility and see firsthand how recycling all construction and demolition debris benefits the state and its sustainable guidelines. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, this is actually one of several facilities in the Twin Cities area that's highly mechanized, and Representative Osmond and I visited this facility, I want to say, in November or December.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Any questions at all? Thanks again. We do have one more person, Mr. Doug Carnival. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the National Solid Waste Management Association, and I just have a couple technical issues that I wanted to raise. Thank you for your open door policy. Some of the members of our association have been in contact with Representative Gardner and have approved the bills tremendously along that line. The technical points we just wanted to make are that in Section 4, dealing with store-separated compostable materials, the last point on line 3.5 seems to be confusing, and we think maybe it's a drafting issue. Store-separated compostable materials in this subdivision are defined as, one, they are such and such, two, are such and such, three, are such and such, four, are such and such, five, it may be delivered to a transfer station. It just seems awkward, and we're not quite sure what Representative Gardner was trying to get at. Perhaps language that would say, are delivered to a transfer station or may have been delivered to a transfer station. That's what you're trying to get across. But we'll be happy to offline talk about the. We don't disagree with any of the concepts. We just think it's a constructive enough for it.
Mark Miller, I'd be happy to work with Mr. Yelof and stakeholders to make that change at the energy committee.
Okay.
The next one, Mr. Chair, is Section 8 on page 5, line 510. Again, more of an issue of drafting, dealing with construction and demolition waste recycling. Again, we agree with these concepts, don't have any difficulty, but I'm told that we might have some concerns about the way it's stated in the last sentence. Waste must be recycled on-site or delivered to a recycling facility, etc. I understand there are some mobile units that exist in which material is put into a mobile unit and neither recycled on-site nor delivered to a facility. So we just want to make sure from a drafting perspective that that those are covered so that people are proceeding with appropriate facilities. And finally, on page 13, line 8.20 Ecuador, having to do with the greenhouse gases, I believe this originally was drafted as an opportunity for offset to greenhouse gas reductions that might have been provided in the cap and trade bill. And I notice on line 8.31, it says projects eligible as offsets include. I'm not sure that's what you want to continue to provide, but you should know that this association does, in fact, favor offsets being permitted for activities that might happen in solid waste that reduce greenhouse gas effects. I don't think that's part of Representative Knuth's bill, but we would be in support of that. But again, a drafting issue that we thought we'd bring your attention. Other than that, Mr. Chair, we have no negative comments about this bill, and thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, people have been working nights, so I appreciate people taking those up.
And any further testimony? Representative Borgenius.
If there's no further testimony, I just have a question or comment. Partners, to get into recycling wallboard, which is a great idea, one of the concerns I have is that there's wallboard coming onto the market now that is made with ash from coal-fired power plants, which includes the burner ash, which means it would have mercury in it. I know there have been studies that say, well, it's locked up in the wallboard. However, it never got to the studies of what happens when you recycle it. And so I think we just need, I think there's only one company that does it. And I just wonder if we need to kind of start addressing that so we don't have stuff that someday we won't be able to recycle, because recycling wallboard should be an easy thing to do. So that is just a concern for the author as we work through this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Borgenius, in fact, what to do with gypsum, drywall, sheetrock is a key issue nationwide, and that's actually one of the issues being discussed. So I appreciate the inquiry. I hadn't thought of it recently, though.
Well, if I could, I do have the list of the companies that make, if you just remind me, I'll get them to you.
Very good.
Make it with ash that includes scrubber ash.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to for House File 3540 as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Energy.
Okay. Representative Gardner renews his motion that House File 3540 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Energy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. So it's passed. Thank you, Representative Gardner, for all your hard work. Yeah.
They're here for guests.
Okay. Next, Representative Moe is not here. Representative Moe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Welcome, Representative Mull.
It's getting late, and we need some stimulating discussion. Perk you all up, so we're going to talk about the Public Facilities Authority. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to move House File 3364.
Yep.
To pass and be referred to finance, to be redirected to higher education and economic development finance. However, that needs to be worded to Mr. Kudelka. That's what I'd want to do.
Yeah. Representative Mo moves House File 3364 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, obviously, this is fairly complicated stuff, but as we know, the Public Facilities Authority provides funding grants to our local units of government for wastewater infrastructure, drinking water, stretches the government dollars as far as we possibly can for very critical needs. There's sections of this bill. Sections 1 through 1 and 2 are wastewater infrastructure funding. Sections 3 and 4 provide additional resources to our local units of government through bonding, and would be additional tools for our local units of government to provide wastewater and drinking water infrastructure. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Terry Coleman, the director, and he will get flesh this thing out and answer your questions.
Mr. Coleman, welcome.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Terry Coleman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. With this bill, there's really two components to it. One, we want to modify the existing wastewater infrastructure funding program, which is the supplemental assistance for wastewater projects, generally high-cost projects, where we put either match the USDA Rural Development Grant, or we provide 0% deferred loans under the clean, with in conjunction with the Clean Water Revolving Fund with this. And the two changes we want to make, the very first one, section in the bill, just kind of want to make sure that the funding that we do is kind of is based on the annual project priority list. We kind of reserve the funds for that priority list, but if they don't proceed, then rather than tie those funds up for long periods of time, because that's kind of how it does now, except for rider language in the bonding bill every year, we figure rather than trying to put rider language in the bonding bill every year, we just do it in statute. So if they don't proceed in a given year, we just roll those funds over and put it on the next highest priority project on the next year's list. That's what Section 1 does. Section 2 modifies the formula for the amount of assistance we provide in two ways. One, in working with USDA Rural Development, we've noticed the trends, costs and their projects going into the $50, $60, $70 range. We'd ask them to lower their grant thresholds to be more competitive and affordable in a lot of our small rural communities that they work with. And they agreed to do that, drop their thresholds from 1.7% of median household income before they kick in grants to 1.5%, which historically has been at for several decades. That will, and they do have a minimum of $35 a month threshold, but that drop will save household costs somewhere in the $5 to $6 a month range. Not a major factor, but in a lot of small communities with fixed income, it is very helpful. Their problem with that is they have loans and they've got grants, and if they reduce their grant threshold, that means there's less loans going into projects. So what we said we would attempt to do, come to the legislature, is increase the state share of the overall grant that they calculate to 65% instead of 50% match, so they can continue to do as many loans as possible to keep them at on a more affordable level. And this came out of a study we did this summer that showed discrepancy in sewer fees across the state. In the metropolitan area, the average sewer fee per household in the 103 communities served by the Met Council is like $15.03. In cities over 2,500 population throughout the state, the average sewer fee is right around $28. And the small communities have been working with USDA Rural Development. Small communities have been working with USDA Rural Development. In under 2,500 population that we've done the last 3 years, been averaging over $50 a month. So we're trying to reduce some of those high costs in the communities that literally have the lowest income of the communities in the state. So that's there. The other thing we found out with larger projects, and I'm talking larger and moderate-sized communities in the state, a lot of them will phase projects, wastewater projects, and do multiple phases, kind of take them a step at a time rather than doing them all at once. We've also found out that when the impaired water TMDL studies are being done, that cities, when their permits are up, they know they have to modify their treatment plant to address the impairments. A lot of these plants are relatively new. And our WIF formula for the non-rural development is every time we make a loan with the Clean Water Revolving Loan Act, when it hits 5% of market value of the community, we trigger the WIF deferred loan for costs over and above that. Well, phase projects, we've become aware that all of a sudden now it's not, they're already paying 5% debt service, now it's 10% debt service. So we want to take into account existing debt service when we calculate WIF. It's just an oversight on our part. when we created the program, because we were looking mostly at small untoured communities, and now we're finding a lot of communities with fairly new facilities that have to be upgraded, and they're already having at that maximum level. So those are two minor changes. The only other change on page three, we forgot one clean water, water pollution control revolving fund when we changed the statutes last year from water pollution control revolving fund to clean water revolving fund. So we'll correct that. The real heart of the bill is trying to come up with access in the credit market for communities that aren't eligible for our subsidized funds. And that's the heart of the bill. We're looking at modifying the current state guarantee program for the county credit enhancement program, which has a state aid intercept and an open appropriation of general fund monies. If there's ever a default in a county general obligation debt, and there never has been in the state of Minnesota, we would request funds from the Department of Finance. If there's any money available in general fund, they would provide those to us. We would pay the bondholders, and then that would trigger state aid intercept on county funds, and we would negotiate repayments of those with the county while they levy whatever needs to be levied or correct their finances so they can pay debt service. That program has given the counties that access it a AAA rating from Standard & Poor's and AA1 from Moody's, and we just found out, or I found out, I didn't realize Fitch rated them, but Fitch rates them as AA+. As well when they get that certification on it. We want to do the same thing with municipalities. We realize they won't necessarily use this program or need this program when they come to us with the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund or the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund to subsidize those rates. But we do not do 100% of the projects, nor can we, with the funds we have, do those. We tend to concentrate on the top half of the list. So one of the things we're looking at doing is at least offering market access in the bond market at a very high investment grade level bond with really no cost, assuming the cities will issue general obligation bonds to do this, and if they want to do it, at least we can get the credit quality and sell the bonds. We also, over the years, noticed there tends to be the cost of borrowing, the further away you get from the Twin Cities, like credits tend to pay higher interest rates in the bond market. It's just lack of knowledge of the bonds that people are buying. If you're buying a bond with a city's name that you're familiar with, you're more likely to buy it when your broker calls up. If you've never heard of the community, you probably, I'm not sure about that. So the market place is a little fickle, and we've noticed we'd like to eliminate some of that discrepancy by putting our name on the bonds. We are a nationally recognized issuer. Have, I think, a fairly good reputation with all the rating agencies and most of the investment banking firms that issue not only in the state of Minnesota but also nationally. Our bonds are highly coveted, and most of the tax-exempt bond funds around the country, especially Minnesota tax-exempt funds. So we're hoping having our name on the bond issues, and as we pool these things, we'll eliminate that regional discrepancy that we have noticed at times. To go through the real quick, all we did in section chapter 446A.06 is delete the word county and substitute government unit, which also includes municipalities, government entities that do have taxing authority and can issue general obligation bonds. And we've also included not only some counties, but anybody that goes through the pooled program on a new section that we're creating in 446A.087, which is the credit enhanced bond program. And so you see the statute before, it's fairly minor additions, just deleting county and putting governmental unit. On the next, section 4, it really creates the bond program, and I've had a couple bond councils work on this, along with Chris Geller from the Attorney General's office. They want very explicit spelled out language, so it is fairly lengthy and detailed. Try to create as much flexibility as possible so the cities can structure their bonds and enter the pool without and have the flexibility. And some of the one flexibility that we want to offer is that they want the cash up front when we close on the bonds. We can give them the cash. They're sophisticated and they can invest it while they spend it in construction projects. That's fine. If they want us to release the funds and invest it, you know, that's an option we'll offer. We generally run around $400 million in investments any given time. We can get much better rates than a lot of cities can on the investment side. So we don't mind. It's just normal course of business for us. So whichever way the city wants to do it, minimize arbitrage, negative arbitrage losses when they issue debt, we'll do whatever they want. So we're structuring the program that way. We also want to make certain things eligible, and we structured the bill so the legislature can look at what we're issuing these bonds for, because they do have the backing of the state's general fund, even though there's never been a defaulted general obligation bond as a part of municipality or county state history, and we don't anticipate any. But we did include wastewater facilities, drinking water facilities, stormwater facilities. We also included street lighting, curb gutters, sidewalks, which tend to be also associated with construction of underground utilities as a replacement of those. Energy conservation, alternative energy sources to use in public buildings, we want to include that as an eligible activity. Telecommunications facility or high-speed internet access is one of the things we're looking at. Public safety buildings and police stations, fire halls, which cities often want some kind of assistance with dealing with public safety. And we also threw in, because one of the things that occurred this past year is the Department of Employment and Economic Development came to the authority and asked us to take over or at least manage several of the community infrastructure funding programs that offer partial grant funding, and we want to include those programs in this pool as well. So when the staff works with those, like redevelopment program and Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure Program, that we can also provide the bond tools to finish the financing of those projects. And that really sums it up. The rest of them are just kind of spells out the application process and options the city has. Any kind of try to spell out market disclosures. So I do want to note on page 11 that we are not general fund supported. Everything the PFA does, we operate on fees. So if we are asking for a $1,000 application fee on these projects for now to see if costs, and up to 10 basis points on the interest. I think the IRS allows up to an eighth of a percent for doing these types of transactions. We don't think we need that much, but so we're asking for less. And if we don't need it, we will charge less, but it does cover our costs. If we can't add value, I don't anticipate cities participating, but I think we can add value in this process, and that fee would be worth it. If not, it won't work. But that kind of sums it up. I'm hoping we'll get AAA rating from S&P and AA one from Moody's. There is $100,000 in the bonding bill in both House and Senate bills that are moving to set this program up and negotiate with rating agencies on any kind of underrated criteria they might want to add over and above to make sure that we get the ratings that make this worthwhile for communities to participate in. And also, we don't want any impact on the state's general obligation bond rating by having that credit enhancement. So that kind of sums it up. It's complicated, but it's simple.
Thank you, Mr. Cooley. Any questions? Representative Moult?
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we'll provide some needed funding for wastewater infrastructure, drinking water programs that aren't currently funded. through the list. Appreciate the committee support.
Representative Moe renews the motion that House File 3364 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion approved. The next bill will be, that we will be taking up will be Representative Knuth, House File 3195.
Representative Knuth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going along with the bill.
Representative Beinart will move House File 3195 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
And I have a lead on it as well.
Representative Hansen will move the House File 3195 DE1 amendment, the delete all amendment. Are there any questions on the delete all amendment? Representative Knuth, do you want to explain the delete all amendment?
Do you want me to go through it? I mean, it's
no.
Or do you want to adopt the amendment first?
No. We can adopt the. All those in favor of the delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. The delete all amendment is adopted. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard a lot of testimony on this bill last week, and we've met with many people interested in this bill, and Representative Anderson over in the Senate, and I have spent a lot of time trying to find more of a compromise bill and more of a bill that we can all be comfortable moving forward with. So I just wanted to go through the basics of the bill and where we made some changes, and then I will answer any questions from the committee. So going through the bill, we took out any findings, and we also took out the definition. And then under the cap and trade program, we changed the intent language in a pretty significant way. We basically said it's the intent of the legislature that Minnesota participate in the Midwest Regional Cap and Trade Program. And then we state the principles that the intent of the legislature is that any cap and trade program would encompass these principles. We took out the word must in changing the language. So the first principle is the sectors included. We removed any of the specific lists. And we just made it pretty clear. We put a basic principle of administratively feasible and excluding sectors from which emissions cannot be reliably quantified. On the auction language, which you heard a lot about last week, we stated that the auction allowances should the allowances should be auctioned to the extent economically feasible, and any proceeds from an auction would go towards the public benefit. So trying to be really clear here. That we think an auction should happen, but if it's not economically feasible and that can be shown, then we wouldn't move in that direction, but also very clear that we want this cap and trade program to benefit the public. Number three is also about auctions, allowing a phase-in if that's needed to protect consumers and industry from sudden price increases, and then also making sure that we have provisions in any cap and trade program that prevents any windfall profits from allocating rather than auctioning allowances. Number four, basically pretty self-explanatory, emission reduction should come from within the cap. And then number five refers to the goals that we set last year, and we're really moving forward on a cap and trade program to meet those goals, so it specifically references them. And then we heard quite a bit of testimony about making sure this doesn't impact specific communities, in an inequitable way. So this could be low-income communities. It could be communities where much of the workforce works in an energy-intensive industry. It's pretty all-encompassing language in number six. So those are the basic principles that we made some significant changes on by after meeting with the stakeholders and talking through some of their concerns. The Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord, Section 3, basically requiring the governor or the administration, the Commissioner of Commerce and Commissioner of PCA to report back about what's been happening towards these negotiations, and then a pretty significant change, but I think a very good government change, is that the House and Senate would appoint a bipartisan team of legislators to serve an advisory role to the negotiators working in the NGA process, and then stating again that any cap and trade program Minnesota agrees to needs to be enacted into law. Next we get to the studies, where I think there's agreement on that studying certain parts of this are pretty important. First is governance study about how to govern any auction revenues that we would get if the auction is determined economically feasible at any level. And then the economic and emissions study, really, I don't think I'm going to go through all the specifics, but we really wanted to bring out the costs and benefits of the cap and trade program, costs on industry and jobs, but also the benefits in terms of new industry, public health, meeting our emissions goals, those sorts of things. So those are, if you want me to go into more detail there, I can, but I think we've made some very significant compromise on this bill, and I would hope for member support.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And there are some folks that would like to testify as well. We have Deb Bergen, who I'd like to call first. Welcome, Ms. Bergen.
Thank you, Chairman Eakin. My name is Deborah Bergen. I'm the manager of state legislative relations for Missouri River Energy Services. I was told earlier today that I had 1 minute, so I will try to stick to that time limit accordingly. First of all, I would like to say that on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services, we think the amendment here before you today and the bill is a step in the right direction. First of all, we do support having a legislative advisory group. We think that is a very good program to implement and to have the legislature advise the governor's office or to have input is important. Secondly, we also like the fact that the current form of the bill doesn't set forth a commitment to 100% auction. You heard a lot of testimony the last time this bill came up regarding that, and I'm not going to reiterate it today, other than to say that Missouri River Energy Services is always favoring a hybrid approach, part auction, part no-cost allowances, as I testified to you last week on this bill. And in that aspect, we support that part of the bill, too. We do have a couple concerns, and I will make them brief. In Subdivision 2, Part 4, regarding ensure that the emission reductions necessary to meet the cap come from cap sectors themselves, we've always supported the fact that offsets or reductions could also come from outside the cap sectors. For example, the propane industry might not come under a cap, but clearly if you can get reductions in that industry, as long as they're verifiable and quantifiable, those should be looked at as an offset. We just hope that that provision or that option is still open to at least be looked at in the NGA. Also on number 5, we understand the importance of not increasing allowances. However, we do support having the MGA and, again, the state legislature and advising the MGA to look at cost relief measures that could come in the form of banking, safety valves the way the RGGI did it, or in other measures, or even no-cost allowances for early action.
other cost relief measures. So we support keeping those options open and available to DMG as well. And with that, I conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Any questions? Ms. Bergen? Trustee Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually more of a question for the author. I guess I would like Representative Canoes to respond to the concerns. I'm glad that you agree with our sound agreement on many of the issues, but when you describe your amendment, and as I understand it, there is some flexibility here for entities to have an off ramp or have a process to go through in case there's an unforeseen problems and or difficulty in meeting the requirements of the bill. Is there not?
I don't know if we want to use the word off ramp, but in terms of the not increasing allowances, Ms. Bergen gave several suggestions in terms of early action banking and looking at some cost measures that REGI uses, and this bill does not really comment on them, so it doesn't forbid them at all. And I actually think greenhouse gases stay in the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a century, so early action would be helpful. And I think it would be reasonable to look at some of the models like REGI did with early action, but it doesn't really make any comment or any suggestions or principle statements on that, and doesn't make any statement on banking either. So to be clear, in terms of if we look at REGI as the one that's almost up and running in terms of a cap and trade in the United States, they don't allow allowances past they allow more offsets at a certain level of price, but they don't allow more allowances above that. Their cap is my understanding of the way their offset provision works. Did I answer your question? Do you have a more specific question?
No, Mr. Chairman. For the most part, I guess in layman's terms, it doesn't prohibit the concerns raised here so far. I mean, you don't.
Well, right now, reductions outside of the cap are not allowed under this bill. I think part of that is we want to make sure this cap is a strong cap, helps us meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals. Another part of that is just the sheer administration of it, because to be actual reductions, you need them to be additional. They wouldn't have happened without the cap and trade program. They need to be verifiable. They need to be permanent. I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be met there. You could also have discussions about where it would that those investments go, if they would be in Minnesota or within the CAP region or within the United States. So there are a lot of discussions about offsets too, but to keep the CAP, to actually meet our goals and to keep a firm CAP, right now it doesn't allow for reductions outside of the CAP. In the principles, I mean, this is legislative intent. Like I said, there's no must, which is a big change from the last bill. Or the last person.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Bergen. Any other questions? And we have Ms. Diane Schmidt. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'll just be very brief. I gave full testimony earlier. I just wanted to say that I think this is still a work in progress. I believe...
If you can state your name.
I'm sorry. Diane Schmidt, representing Flint Hills Resources. I just wanted to say that while we appreciate that there has been some work on this bill, we still think there needs to be a lot of additional considerations, and we hope that the authors in both the House and Senate will continue to work with a variety of communities that still feel that they haven't had all their concerns addressed, particularly in light of the fact, as I testified earlier, that some of the industries like ours are somewhat unique and haven't been as thoroughly investigated as, say, the electric energy has in the past. And so as we start going into additional sectors, I think it's extremely important through this economic study that we start figuring out so that we can let the public know what the cost will be to them as individuals, particularly in the price of fuel. So I just wanted to say that for the record, that we still think there are some concerns we would like to continue to discuss with the author. I hope that she will continue to work with all of us as this proceeds. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Ms. Smith, any questions, though? Okay. We have next Ms. Christina Wessel.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just have a quick moment here. My name is Christina Wessel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research and analysis on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to their impact on low and moderate income Minnesotans, which is why I'm here today. There is no doubt that climate change is one of the most serious issues facing our country and our state, and we strongly support making progress on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But effective climate change efforts should not lose sight of the serious impact those policies could have on low-income Minnesotans already struggling financially. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a think tank in Washington, D.C., estimates that the lowest-income households in the United States will face increased energy costs averaging $750 to $950 per year as a result of even modest efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is a group whose average income is about $13,000 a year, or $27,000 for a family of three. However, auctioning allowances would provide the resources necessary to help offset the cost for these low-income families already struggling to make ends meet. Fortunately, the cost of helping them may not be as high as you expect. The center has estimated at the national level it would take only a modest percentage of the resources that could be obtained through an auction, about 14%, to fully offset the cost of the bottom 20% and partially offset the cost for those with modestly higher incomes. We believe that our state and our nation must act quickly to prevent further damage to our environment, but we can do it in a way that does not put these very important efforts at odds with the work that is happening in other committees to reduce and prevent poverty in our state. Whether we auction allowances or we allocate them, energy-related costs for low-income families will increase and place additional financial burdens on them. With an auction, we will at least have some resources to help hold these families harmless as they are working to move from poverty to self-sufficiency. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wessel. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Brad Ladle. Welcome,
Mr. Ladle. Chair, and committee members, and I'll make it fairly quick. My name is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And I know that some of you are probably thinking, Minnesota AFL-CIO, why are we here with in support of Representative Knuth's bill on climate change and greenhouse gases? Our General Board of the Minnesota AFL-CIO on November 29th. Of 2007 adopted a number of principles, actually, that some of which were in the original bill, less so in the amended bill. The lateness of the day, I can certainly handle that or make those available to the committee in the future, whichever you prefer. But we do still support House File 3195. And are appreciative, at least, of some of the provisions in here to look at dislocation and that sort of thing in the process, but we do support it. We can all see that in some ways the train has left the station. The governor has already agreed on a regional cap and trade. Agreed to discuss the regional cap and trade system. Some people would rather have a discussion on whether it's allocation or auction or whatever, but some people would like to rather have a national. I'm sure that's going to be discussed as well. Just having had a lot of experience with state federations and international unions from both sides of the both coasts, I would say that we believe the Midwest actually is more of a common sense approach on many things, and I think that this would be helpful and actually helpful with the national version. The other thing is that this is now principles and a lot of things, and I think providing some insight from the legislature, maybe to the governor and whichever a governor, whether he's Democrat, Republican, or Independent, I think it's going to be very helpful to have some idea, because I think it's unlikely that we can expect any of the other states that are going to be negotiating this that their legislatures haven't weighed in on or aren't going to weigh in on any of this, and I think if that would help as well. So, anyways, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Yeah, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Leto? Seeing none, thank you. And Representative Knuth, did you have any, if there's any further questions for Representative Knuth, Representative Beinart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more of a comment. I just want to thank you for your persistence in the face of very difficult issues and carrying forward an issue that's really critical, I think, to our future at all levels. And I respect your work, and I know we'll continue to move this forward. So thank you.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your comments, Representative Beinart. I think we did some serious work between last week and this week in trying to find more of a common ground, but and still working on this principle that the legislature needs to be involved in such a large process, as well as the principle that we want a cap-and-trade program that works for Minnesota and the Midwest region that benefits the public and addresses this problem in as fair and equitable way as possible. And we're really trying to get at that with this bill, and I would hope the committee supports it.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. I do want to thank you for the hard work you've put in and working with all the stakeholders on this as well to come up with a compromise agreement. With that, any further comments or questions? And Representative Beinart, I believe you made the motion. If you'd like to
I'll renew my motion that we... is this moving forward to another committee?
Yes.
So what's the full
committee
motion?
Committee on Commerce.
Okay, that we pass House File... what is this number here? 3195 and move it forward to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. Representative Beinart moves that House File 3195 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen.
No, not here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
I'd like to move House File 3429 pass to be recommended to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves that House File 3429 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one small oral amendment.
Okay, state your amendment, please.
I could move on line 4.32. After renew strike A, and insert two words, thus related.
Representative Hansen moves the oral amendment on line 4.32 after renew strike A and add the related. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Chair and members of the committee, House File 3429 is extending the authority, the administrative penalty authority that had been with the Pollution Control Agency, was extended last year to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and extending that to the Department of Natural Resources relating to Chapters 84, 103F, and 103G. And I have the DNR here, someone to go through the bill quick.
For the record, my name is Jim Kraft. I'm the Assistant Director for the DNR Division of Water. What this bill does is it gives the Commissioner authority to issue administrative penalty orders. That's in Section 1 there. An administrative penalty order is a civil citation for a water violation, which would take the form of a fine and or an order for corrective action. And it would be only used for egregious and repeat offenses of DNR water permit programs that are listed in Section 1 there. Section 2 gets into the administrative order procedure, the contents of the order, the amount of the penalty, and how that would be developed. And at the end, I'll talk a little bit about that. There's a provision in subdivision 3 there that would also provide the commissioner the authority to issue the order, and then it provides how the recipient would respond within 31 days. Subdivision 4 says that if they do take corrective actions, that we can forgive all of the penalty, all or part of the penalty. Subdivision 5 is a long part of the bill, and it relates to the expedited administrative hearing process, which is found in the administrative hearing procedures, Chapter 14. I only want to point out paragraph D and E in that subdivision. D says that if the administrative law judge finds for the department that it was a frivolous complaint and that he finds for us, that we can go back and recover costs. And E says that if the administrative law judge finds for the recipient, that we must refund all the costs charged to the person receiving the order. So a little bit of each. In subdivision 6, it provides for alternative dispute resolution if both parties agree. Subdivision 7 goes into enforcement measures if there's a failure to pay the penalty or comply with the order. Subdivision 8 would allow us to not issue new permits for a similar sort of violation. So if somebody has violated a permit, we wouldn't necessarily give them another permit for the same reason. There's a cumulative remedy that would say that we can use the administrative penalty order in addition to our other authorities for cease and desist, restoration orders, and criminal citations. But there's an exception that we cannot seek civil penalties under other provisions of laws or violations that are already covered under the administrative penalty order. Section 3 relates to recovery of litigation costs and expenses if the violation is proven to be willful and that we are successful in winning the case. And then Section 4 relates to how we're going to be implementing the plan for the administrative penalty orders, and you basically develop an implementation plan by December 31st of this year, and that would detail how we would come up with the costs for the penalties and things like that, show how various degrees of minor to severe penalties would be assessed. The maximum fee would be $10,000, and we would expect to use that very, very rarely.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jaffe. Any questions at all? Mr. Jaffe or Representative Hansen? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, is this, I'm trying to understand this bill, is this for putting a penalty on, for instance, draining a wetland? Is that what we're getting at here, or are we getting at some other issue?
Representative Hansen or Scalzi, we dealt with a number of the Bowser regulations with APO authority last year. This bill was brought to me by the Department of Natural Resources looking at having that same authority. If you look at chapters 84, 84 deals with a lot of DNR rules. 103F and 103G deal with a lot of the water's jurisdiction in the
DNR area, and I've got the legal peers if you're interested in looking at houses.
No, I'm not.
that's on it. Thank you. Yeah.
So,
I agree. Any other questions? Representative Hackworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe the department can answer. Is this a bill that was around a couple years ago, too? The same one that didn't pass a couple years ago? You were looking for an administrative penalty order a couple years ago, too, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackworth, that's correct.
Pretty much the same bill?
Any other questions?
Representative Wagenius, I don't think you were in favor of that bill a couple years ago when I was here.
Representative Hackworth, I have always supported administrative penalty orders from the very beginning, yes, because they, I don't like to make criminals out of people for things that they probably should, for messes they've made, we should probably just make them clean up their messes.
Representative Olin.
Representative Hansen, this is just a curiosity question. Are there other administrative penalties, et cetera, provided in these three statutes? And if so, have you done anything but to clean those up, or are we dealing with a double set of standards? I have, without looking, I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, you have criminal and civil authority in these statutes, but they did not have the administrative penalty. You didn't have the structure, and I refer to Mr. Jaff if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Jaff?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
That's the only question I had. The only reason I asked is I didn't have all those provisions right in front of me, and I hadn't looked in detail to make sure there wasn't something there that happened before.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I'd like your consideration to what we have a couple of stops to go, so I'd like to ask something about. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3429 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Hansen. That is it for today. Meeting is adjourned.